Sands, The American Century.
The story of how the United States became a superpower at the head of a new global order and the invisible hands that guided it.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4. BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 22nd of August. This is Alan Smith. Good morning. The video sharing app TikTok has agreed to pay $400 million, the equivalent of £293 million, after being accused in the United States of violating children's online privacy. The US Justice Department called the settlement a major victory for parents and their children, saying they were safer now than when the case began. Our North America correspondent Lily Jamali reports.
This agreement is being called one of the largest child privacy settlements in history. The lawsuit was brought by the U.S. Department of Justice in 2024 when Joe Biden was president. The department alleged TikTok and its parent company ByteDance collected vast amounts of data on millions of users under the age of 13, including names and email addresses. TikTok had been accused of violating the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, a federal law known as COPPA. That same law is the one several U.S. states allege that Meta has violated, which it denies. That case is currently being heard by a court in California. YouTube and the Fortnite maker Epic Games have also reached settlements over alleged breaches of COPPA. A representative for TikTok contacted for comment by the BBC did not respond.
The economist Lord O'Neill says he will not be taking a job in Andy Burnham's government. He'd been advising the Prime Minister and previously served as Treasury Minister under the Conservatives. More details from our political correspondent David Cornock.
Jim O'Neill, a former chief economist at Goldman Sachs, had been tipped to become the Prime Minister's chief economic adviser. But as first reported by the Financial Times, he's decided not to take a government job. He said he was enjoying what he's currently doing too much and didn't want to have to give up control of his business interests to comply with official rules. The crossbench peer stressed his decision was not due to policy disagreements, and he was a massive fan of Andy Burnham's focus on devolution.
The United States has imposed 50% tariffs on some imports from Canada after 3 days of trade talks in Washington failed to reach an agreement. Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney has vowed to retaliate dollar for dollar. A six-year-old girl who was rescued from the water off the coast of West Sussex on Tuesday has died in hospital. Saja El-Hawass's mother, father and older sister Sarah all died during the incident in Shoreham. Here's our UK correspondent Daniel Sanford.
It was on Tuesday afternoon that four members of the British-Palestinian family from London got into difficulty in the water near the old fort. Despite the rescue efforts, Hassan El-Hawass, his wife Zaina Elaine and their 14-year-old daughter Sarah all died. Her younger sister, 6-year-old Saja, survived and was taken to hospital in a critical condition. But Sussex police have confirmed that she has now also died. The force said that after looking at CCTV footage and talking to eyewitnesses, they currently think the deaths were a tragic accident.
BBC News has been told the Duchess of Sussex is in talks to appear in a TV series being made by Netflix. There's been speculation that a return to her former acting career is one of the reasons Meghan and Prince Harry are moving back to the UK. Here's our senior royal correspondent, Daniela Relf.
The BBC has learnt that the Duchess of Sussex is in talks to appear in the Netflix series The Gentleman. Discussions are in their early stages, but this would be the first significant acting role for Meghan since her marriage to Prince Harry. Much of the two previous series of the show have been filmed in the Cotswolds, close to where it's rumoured Harry and Meghan will set up home in the UK. Although the details of a possible role for Meghan have not been revealed, it's becoming increasingly clear that her return to acting has been an important part of the family decision to come back to the UK.
That's the BBC News. We'll take a look at Saturday's papers in a minute, but first with the weather, here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thank you, Alan. Well, we've had some fairly welcome rainfall at times over the past few days, but high pressure is now moving in from the Atlantic and squeezing the showers away. So for the vast majority, the weekend is looking dry with some sunshine, and temperatures will be creeping up a little bit by day, but do expect some fairly chilly nights. Now, today we've got a few isolated showers around. This morning there's a few heavy ones across North Wales, also one or two around the east coast of England, and a few for the northwest of Scotland. Most of the showers will ease through the day, but we will continue to have one or two here and there, especially across the Highlands and Islands in Scotland. Further south, you've got some longer spells of sunshine, but cloud will tend to bubble up into the afternoon. Temperatures today across the northern half of the UK around 16 to 20 degrees, further south 21 to 23 Celsius. Stays dry overnight, but temperatures will get down into mid-single figures for some of us, a few misty patches. Tomorrow, another largely dry day with some sunshine and temperatures probably a touch warmer than today. Tomorrow, we're looking at around 18 to 24 degrees.
Thank you, Sarah. Now for a look at the morning papers, and the Daily Mail splashes on the High Court ruling about costs in Prince Harry's failed privacy claim against the paper's publishers, Associated Newspapers. The day of reckoning, the paper calls it, saying the claimants, including Prince Harry and Sir Elton John, will now have to pay millions to the Mail. The Times reports the claimants' legal insurance only covers up to £16.2 million. That would leave a possible shortfall of £18 million. Many of the papers also have reports that the Duchess of Sussex is in talks to appear in Guy Ritchie's Gentleman series for Netflix. According to The Sun, she's said to be very excited about a role in the show. The Daily Star points out it will be Meghan's first acting role in 8 years. The Daily Telegraph reports that the criminal investigation into whether Lord Mandelson passed confidential government information to Jeffrey Epstein is at risk of collapse. Scotland Yard detectives are said to believe it's increasingly unlikely that the US Department of Justice will hand over key unredacted Epstein files, which may be needed to charge the former Labour cabinet minister with misconduct in public office. Lord Mandelson has denied any wrongdoing. According to The Guardian, MPs have accepted almost £400,000 worth of hospitality to concerts and sporting events this year. The paper said they'd failed to learn lessons from the outcry when Keir Starmer accepted football tickets and clothing in 2024. Louise Hay, Lucy Powell, Wes Streeting are among those who have accepted the tickets. Labour said declarations had been in line with parliamentary rules. And the Financial Times reports that world powers are pushing to argue how to measure the passage of time on the moon. Clocks there tick fractionally faster than on Earth because of differing gravitational pull. The countries are due to vote in October on proposals for what the paper calls Greenwich Moon Time. And that's our look at the papers. In half an hour, it's Farming Today this week, which will be looking at solar power. That's just after 6:30. But now on Radio 4, here's Martha Carney with a new series of Open Country.
I'm hammering out an orangey red piece of metal here in a really authentic reproduction of a Roman forge at the Ancient Technology Centre in Dorset, which I'm visiting for Open Country. And I'm learning how to make the kind of tools, the knives, that the Saxons would have done. Anthony Whitlock is the tutor here, and you've been teaching children here all morning. Now, I can see your fire's going down a little bit. Shall I have a go at the bellows?
If you're happy to, that'd be brilliant. Yeah, I'll put a bit more charcoal on. There's a handful of charcoal.
Just tell me when to start bellowing. Normally people are telling me to stop bellowing.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, if you're happy to start now, so... Yeah, so up and there, so one... Yes, perfect.
Alternating, yes. So alternating. This is double-handed bellows.
Absolutely.
This is a very good workout.
It is, actually. And that way there's a continuous supply of oxygen going down into the fire.
And we can see the sparks and the flames actually beginning to rise up above the kiln. What's the kiln made of?
So it's a mixture. So the bed is just a big pile up of chalk, just mounded up on chalk. So you're working at sort of like a more reasonable height.
And then you put the metal in. And what are we making today?
So we're making a copy of a Saxon kitchen knife. So nothing sort of big and fighty.
And how hot do you have to get the metal in order to be able to mould it?
So it's going to get to about 800 degrees centigrade. So it's glowing bright orange at that point. So obviously, you know, back in the day, people don't have thermometers that can tell you precisely. So people will be very much looking at the colour. So when it's, you've got that bright orange, you know it's kind of soft. And it's going to go through the process of cooling back to like a cherry red and then back to sort of like the grey of the metal again.
Well, the whole point of the Technology Centre is to teach children about the kind of skills and crafts that were common in the past. So let's bring a couple of the boys in now.
So right now we've got Josh on the bellows. So Josh is feeding the fire with oxygen. Joe is waiting here to hammer, so it's going to be made in front of you. Sort of hard and fast controlled hits that sort of work your way up and down the range a bit. And you're nearly there, Josh. That's brilliant work on the bellows. So stand by to have a rest. I'll count you down. 3, 2, 1, stop. Okay, Joe. 3, 2, 1, go. That's great. So nice, hard and controlled and fast hits. That's brilliant. Had you down from 5 and we're going to stop. So 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Amazing. Well done.
Josh, that looked amazing. What have you been doing?
We've been getting it hot to like mould a shape to make a butter knife from the Anglo-Saxons period.
I guess this is not really part of an ordinary school day, is it?
Where
you get to play with incredibly hot metal.
Yeah, it's more of a like a hand-on day than like listening.
This is one of the hottest days of the year so
far.
What are we doing inside a forge?
It's worth it. I know it's really hot, but like, you're not going to really experience doing this like ever again, really. And it's really fun.
Definitely really fun. And Josh, what do you think you've learnt about what life was like back then?
That it's not like the world has developed and it's not as easy. All we need to do is go to the shop, but they had to like make it in hot conditions, even when it's hot, and no like ice packs to cool them down or something.
Would you like to have lived back then?
It would depend on what I'm doing, because I wouldn't like to do this on a hot day, but I guess it would be like, it'd make me more like responsible, and like it would make me be a lot different, because I'm doing lots of like different stuff compared to like going to a shop and get knives. I'd be making the knives and that.
So the Ancient Technology Centre was set up around 40 years ago, actually. So we're approaching the 40th anniversary by a teacher at the school next door, the middle school, called Jake Keane, who decided to build an Iron Age roundhouse with his class as a design and technology project using local materials. They went to a local woodland and coppiced hazel, which they then wove into the walls and built the roof from, and it was thatched with local water reed. And that was there for only about a year. Unfortunately, it got burnt down, so there was a collective money-raising event in the village, and they built another one, and that one was there for about 25 years. So the current roundhouse we have that we still use for activities has been here since 2012. But in that period, the centre has grown fairly organically, so buildings have kind of like sprung up over the years.
I've never been to an ancient technology centre. What's the idea behind it?
So it's very much about getting children with their hands into kind of projects and processes from the past. So getting their hands dirty, you know, hands-on learning. Children are increasingly spending more and more time indoors and less time outdoors.
On screens.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a perfect way, really, for them to experience what it might be to live in the past. So it brings history to life, you know, rather than sitting in the classroom looking at a book, they're coming and they're experiencing it. They're gaining in confidence. Quite often you get children here that might not do so well in the classroom, like in an academic setting, but you bring them out here, you get them, you know, hammering a piece of metal or making some string from stinger nettles or making some chalk into some daub that they're then going to push onto a wall of a roundhouse. So hands-on learning in a nutshell.
Now, Clive Perrin, you've been a volunteer here for, what, 40 years, right since it began?
Indeed.
And we're just surrounded by so many really weird-looking buildings and structures, and I guess they're from all sorts of different periods of time.
Exactly. The first thing you see is the open field in front of us, where the children at the moment are playing some Roman game of some sort. Saxon house on the right where the children are. We've got the Viking longhouse immediately on our left.
And tell me, what is that building over there that looks slightly like where a hobbit might live?
We're looking towards the Earth House. It's Teletubby House, that's what they all say. Oh, Teletubbies!
That is right, it does look like Teletubbies.
And it is, it's just a mound, a burial mound with a big door in the front. That is a creation based on... It's three structures from the Iron Age in the Isle of Man.
And would it have been used for meetings in a building like this in Iron Age times?
How do we know? Like a lot of archaeology, the only evidence we've got is what's lying in the soil. And above that, we have to conjecture what might have been above. Might have been open, like Stonehenge. But then Stonehenge might have had a roof. So we're in the porch now, and we're about to enter the mound, the Earth House. First of all, we've got to open the door.
Those are heavy old doors, aren't they? Isn't it lovely coming in here because it's so cool on a very hot summer's day?
Well, we're effectively underground, aren't we?
Because we're under the huge earth, layer of earth.
20 tonnes of earth.
20 tonnes. What a clever design idea.
And what's also interesting about it is it's untouched chalk downland on the top. Nothing's been up there except sheep.
We have sheep grazing on the roof.
Yeah. How do you keep the grass in control?
Well, I'm glad that it's held up by such strong pieces of timber, all that earth and the sheep as well.
These are massive oaks, and they came from the Drax estate down in Dorset.
So all the materials come from quite a local area,
oh, yeah,
do they?
Yeah.
Clive, you've been volunteering here for 40 years, and I can tell your huge enthusiasm for the place. And what is it about the Ancient Technology Centre that you find so inspirational?
Fundamentally, because it's a place of teaching, and to see what it does for youngsters of this age, I don't know how old they are, 7, 8, having fun in an environment which they've never seen before, and at the same time learning about it and then picking up on the ancient skills. What they don't realise is that it's the skill of their ancestors that begat them and got them here today. How did they build things like Stonehenge? And we even get them practising on that big rock there. They will be tied to it and told to move it up to the top of the site. There'll be stuff lying around which will aid them in their decision-making, like big rollers, levers to lift the stone up onto the... They learn mathematics, physics.
So it really is bringing history to life, isn't it?
And all these things have evolved because of the skill of the human mind and hand. So now we're going to walk down towards the Viking longhouse.
Inside we can see that there's a class going on right inside the Viking longhouse, and the tutor here is Jen Heath. What's going on?
So today the children have come to study Anglo-Saxon Day, and as part of that they're learning how to use heddle looms, a really nice simple way of going over and under and showing how weaving works. We've also looked at some sheep's fleece, and they've handled it the closest they'll get to our sheep today probably, and they looked at how natural dyes will change the colour of fabrics as well. So as you can hear, they're doing a little rhyme that I've taught them on how to do the weaving, so I like to hear that because it shows they're doing it properly.
Wood to wood, slide, beat, 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 and pull through, and change.
So just tell me, what are you doing here?
Weaving.
With lots of different colours?
Yeah.
How complicated is it?
Zero. It's kind of complicated, but it's quite easy as well.
What are you going to make in the end? What are you hoping to make?
Not sure. Maybe a bookmark, a really long bookmark.
Or a bracelet, like for a giant.
Yeah. Yeah, a bracelet for a giant or a bookmark for a giant. Yeah. You've got a really long piece here. But
yeah.
What's this? What is this called?
The head.
And this?
It's the shuttle.
Yeah. And then this is the yarn that we need to weave through with.
And what have you been learning about the way that Anglo-Saxons used to live in the past?
Well, they had very nice clothes. If they were rich, they had longer clothes because then they could repay them if it went wrong.
And the men had short ones to their knees on their clothes, and the women had to their ankles.
They had longer dresses,
yeah,
did they?
Yeah. Wood to wood, slide, beep, 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 pull through. Okay, so like because it's red already.
We've got another couple of girls doing some weaving. Do you think you'd like to have lived back in Anglo-Saxon times?
I wouldn't say so because I don't want to eat animals because I want them to live so then they have a great time.
How about you? Would you like to have been an Anglo-Saxon girl?
Because I don't want to be in war and like die because of war. I want to like try and live as much and do fun things.
It did sound like quite bloodthirsty times, didn't it? All those battles.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I'll let you carry on with your weaving.
Josh, how was the rest?
Good. Welcome back, Maximus. Don't start eating yet. We're going to do one thing before lunchtime. Everyone's attention, looking this way.
The lunches should still be in bags at this point.
We're going to do one last thing before you have your lunchtime, and that is start a fire in a really Anglo-Saxon way. Now, I had a quick chat with a couple of people about how to do that. Women in Age of Metal, pure metal. Those people who've just done blacksmithing, you've done some metal. We're going to use a flint and a steel. You guys know about the fire triangle, don't you? There's three things that are needed to start a fire and keep it going. Who can tell me something in the fire triangle? Someone who hasn't said something yet.
Yeah.
Oxygen.
Oxygen. All around us. Great. Done. What else do we need?
Heat.
Heat. We're going to have heat with our friction. And Austin, what would be the last one?
Fuel.
Exactly. So our fuel at this instance is going to be our straw bundle and some skinny bits of kindling and bark peelings moving on to the bigger wood. So I'm going to need an intermediary device to catch a spark, and it is a little piece of cloth that has already gone into the fire and been blackened or charred, and so we're going to call it char cloth. It's a bit of linen. So I'm hoping that if this catches a spark, it will create an ember that I can then go through my kindling process with. So everyone think warm thoughts, please, not hard on a day like today. And then finally, you get a little orange glowing ember, which I can blow on, Jelly, and you can see it glowing. And then we can get some flames going on. I'll quickly bomb the flames, turn my straw bundle over onto it so it catches the flames, and that's when I'm going to go onto my smaller bits of kindling.
One of the most popular things to do at the Ancient Technology Centre is learning how to nap flint. So that's exactly what one of the tutors, Nada Kreischer, is going to show me what to do. And we're surrounded by big
lumps of rock.
Lovely, yes. So we have got some big lumps of flint here. So this is one of the oldest technologies. It's the oldest one we have evidence for, going back 3.5 million years almost.
How do we know that these were tools rather than just pieces of flint?
That's a really good question. So the fact that they're intentionally made, you can work it out by looking at the pieces, because the way flint breaks is very distinctive. So rocks that we use in flint knapping have to have certain properties. So flint is one of them, obsidian is another. They break in a specific way, and it's the same way glass breaks. When you strike it, the force spreads out equally in all directions. So I'm going to break a piece off now, like this. So I've struck the piece from the core.
So a much slimmer piece of flint is broken off.
Yes, you've
broken
it off. We call these a flake. So we would call this the big piece a core of flint, or a nodule of flint. And the piece that's broken off we call a flake, because it looks a flake of flint. And where you strike it, you get a mark, which we call the point of percussion. That's the point where you struck it, where you hit it.
So this flake is pretty sharp on the edges, mm-hmm. isn't it? Oh, gosh. I can see why they would think this would be a very useful tool to have. I'm going to be careful not to cut myself with it.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's why they were doing it, because it gave them an advantage over just their teeth and their claws and their nails, rather, when it came to processing food. So, yeah, that's the point of percussion there. Underneath, you've got the bulb of percussion, which is where the force has spread into this side of a rock, met lots of resistance, can't form, and then it's gone to the sides instead, where it's met less resistance and it can break there. So all those signs are things that an archaeologist, if they were digging up a stone tool, would spot and use to say this is probably made by somebody doing it intentionally.
So this is rather surreal. On the roof, the turf roof of the earth house, a sheep has just appeared.
Yeah, we have 4 heritage breeds of sheep on site. Astrid! So this one is one of our Shetland sheep. They're brand new. They're a bit escape artists, so they keep getting out into the local fields, and we get phone calls saying, come and gather them up. But luckily they're very greedy, so just shake the food bucket and they'll come up and follow us in. But yeah, it's lovely to have them around, and the children love it, because it's a real chance to see what it would be like for our ancestors living around farm animals. And they're just free roaming, so they just go where they want to on site.
What's the purpose of an archaeologist learning how to do flint knapping?
So there's lots of really good reasons to learn. One is so that if you find something, you can recognise what it is. But there's also a whole branch of archaeology called experimental archaeology, where you practice technologies and techniques that people did in the past and use them to answer the questions you have about it. So, for instance, if you found a stone tool and you wanted to work out what it was used for, instead of just looking at it and examining it, you would make a copy, use it, and work out how it performs in different situations. So how it performs cutting wood compared to cutting animal skin, something like that. And that can give you so much information that you can't get any other way. You can't get through scientific tests. You can only get by practically carrying out the task.
So are you able to teach me how to do it?
I'd love to. Right, so I will give you a piece of leather just to protect your clothes. If you pop that on, are you right-handed or left-handed?
I'm right-handed.
Right-handed, so pop that on your left leg. So we'll be working kind of in between our knees here. Let me grab you a piece. Right, so you can support that on your leg there.
Yeah.
I'll give you a rock. Here you go. So the rocks we hit the cores of, we call these hammer stones. So they're not made out of flint, because if you're hitting one with the other, it might end up exploding in your face. So we don't want that. So this is some kind of, I think it's a hard sandstone, this. You're going to be striking the rock about there-ish.
Yes.
You're going to be using what we call a precision blow rather than a power blow. So you're going to be holding it between your thumb and your fingers, like that.
Yeah.
And you'll be aiming kind of straight down like this, because flint knapping is all about angles. Straight down, and you want, a bit like tennis, you want follow through. So you want all of the energy to be going into the rock.
Right.
Let's give it a go.
Okay, 3, 2, 1.
That's good. And let's just bring it around here, straight on top there. That's good. Yeah, striking right at the top there. You just need to bring it a bit closer to the edge. That's good. Again. Nice. Yeah. Chip some off the edge there. So you took a little bit off the edge there. That's fine. If we come round and strike here, yes, you should be able to get a bigger piece there.
Okay, yes. Just a few flakes came off, didn't they? So I'll try the Wimbledon follow through as well.
Straight down. Nice. There we go. So this one.
Oh, this is a better size, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a nice big piece, which you could easily shape into a tall.
It's got rather beautiful markings in the centre of this piece of flint as well, isn't it?
Yeah, this stuff comes from a quarry in Bury St Edmunds. So we order it in big tun bags because it's a gravel quarry and they don't want the flint. So we buy it off
them.
That is
so funny, because I live near Bury St Edmunds.
Oh, do you? Yeah, it's a good flint area.
It is. Our church is made of flint.
Oh, really?
I was thinking if they need any repairs.
Yes, you can volunteer now. Yeah, there's some beautiful buildings made out of flint. I think that's how the flint napping was kind of kept going, the building out of flint. And you can see very quickly, you can learn how to do it.
Well, thank you so much. A skill I never thought I would learn how to do. It's quite strange, but I can't stop stroking this little piece of flint that I've been taught how to shape. And just having this in my hand means I feel a kind of connection with our ancestors so many millions of years ago. To learn about the kind of tools that they use, it gives a real insight into the past. And I wish we'd had this kind of thing when I was at primary school.
Open Country was recorded at the Ancient Technology Centre in Dorset. It was presented by Martha Carney and produced in Bristol by Beth O'Dea. Now, I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that it's been a summer of drought and extreme heat for much of the UK. Well, all this week, Farming Today has been talking about solar energy, from large-scale solar developments to rooftop panels on farm buildings. It's a topic that can raise blood pressures for some. So, after another tough year for farmers, in a minute, Farming Today this week, we'll be asking if diversification like solar power could make all the difference to the bottom line. That's after this look ahead to tomorrow.
The ringing room is going to get very hot and sweaty and probably very humid. Those are not nice conditions for ringing a 3-ton ring of bells.
It's competition time for the bell ringers of St Martin's in the Bullring.
It's difficult, it's complex.
At this year's National 12 Bell Striking Contest.
Birmingham has 26 wins. In second place, the college youths have won 5 times.
But will they regain their title?
I think we're satisfied.
No mistakes, and it all felt pretty good.
Ringing the Bullring on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, tomorrow night at 7:15.
This is BBC Radio 4, where we'll join the Today programme at 7 o'clock. But first, it's Farming Today this week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning and welcome to Farming Today this week. It's been a summer of drought, extreme heat and, for so much of the country, lots and lots of sunshine. And all week on Farming Today, we've been talking about solar energy, from large-scale solar developments to rooftop panels on farm buildings. Now, this is a topic that raises blood pressures. Some rural communities feel that too much good growing land is being turned into an industrial landscape as solar panels march across fields. Others say it's a small price to pay for clean, renewable energy. And for farmers, after another tough year, a diversification like solar power could make all the difference to the bottom line. Well, to help us explore some of the issues around solar panels in more depth, we have three guests. Dr. Jonathan Scurlock, who's a renewable energy consultant and a former advisor to the National Farmers Union. He's joining us from the studio in Birmingham. Jackie Copley, who's head of policy at the CPRE, or the Campaign to Protect Rural England, and also a chartered town and country planner. She joins us from the studio in Salford. William Ulashalis joins us from Cirencester, where he's a lecturer in rural land management at the Royal Agricultural University. Well, good morning to all of you. Let's start with some basics. Jonathan, how much solar do we actually have in the UK, and how much farmland is being used?
At the moment, government statistics say about 22,000 megawatts of solar. But for people who don't, you know, can't get their heads around that, in terms of land area, we're looking at something of the order of 20,000 hectares, about 50,000 acres of land, where solar farms make up about 60% of that total. The remainder then being roughly equally distributed between domestic household rooftops and then larger industrial and commercial rooftops.
And looking into the future, what's the government target? How much land might we be looking at in the longer term?
Well, the government has a couple of different targets. Looking out to about 2030, under their Clean Power 2030 plan, the expectation is that we would be getting to somewhere between 40 and 50 gigawatts of solar, a little bit more than double the current estimate, bearing in mind that there's actually quite a lot of solar development now currently under construction and going through the pipeline. This is still a very fast-growing industry, mainly driven by an increasing demand for electrification and falling cost of the generation from solar across all different kinds of platforms.
Jackie Copley from CPRE, why are people so upset about solar on farmland when actually there isn't that much of it? It's less than 0.5% so far.
Well, it does cause a lot of rural strife. It does predominantly focus on our most productive soils. And because of frequent flooding, we are going to have to make wiser choices in terms of where we grow our food, where we recover our nature, and in terms of climate adaptations. And it does impact tenanted farms who are being evicted or having a reduced amount of land to grow food on. So it is impacting people's livelihoods, and people are very upset about industrialisations of very beautiful countryside. So it causes frustration. People feel they're not being heard. And of course, we need to resolve climate impacts by making sure we fulfil our clean power goals. But we just think it could be done in a way which builds consensus rather than division. And these very, very large solar farms or developments, some of them are over 2,000 hectares. They're very, very large. And we're calling on the government to reduce the amount of solar that is aimed at the ground. And we'd like more rooftop and wasted space, such as car parks, to be utilised. Why not use those obvious spaces first?
We will talk more about that later in the programme. William, at the moment, what decides, if you like, where solar panels go? If a farmer says to a land agent, I'm thinking about this, what do they need to think through and what really will drive that decision?
I think it's probably the other way round, is that it's the suppliers who are looking for sites around the country to put solar farms on. So quite often the landowner is the one who's approached.
And it seems that actually it's how easy the connection is that will be probably the most important factor.
That's the sort of supplier-led. The landowner is really looking at it as a business decision. Is it going to make a difference to their business? And the reality is, at the moment, that the returns that you get from agriculture versus the returns you can get from solar agreements, forgive me, they are complex. So it all sounds very straightforward on this discussion, but they are complex. The returns you'll probably get are going to be significantly higher.
And also they're guaranteed, aren't they? So we've had a terrible harvest. Farmers have spent time and money on a crop which is now losing them money. Whereas if you sign up for 30 years, you know what's happening for the next 30 years.
Yes, indeed. But 30 years is a long old time to sign up for.
Well, as Jackie pointed out, one of the big arguments here is where you put solar panels. And many feel we should be putting more on rooftops, not in fields. And that's what dairy farmer Mick Dakin is doing at Masson Farm in Derbyshire. He's put solar panels on the roof of his farm buildings.
We've reduced the bills through summer currently from £1,200 per month down to £200 per month. We had to install some extra timber purlins to strengthen the roof. But on the ice cream production, because it's a new building, we had no structural requirements. But certainly on our farm, it was a no-brainer because the roof would take them. My personal opinion is that's where the best place to put them on a farm is. I'm nothing against them in fields, if that's what the person who owns a field would prefer, but it didn't suit us.
Jonathan, as I say, this has been raised by our listeners. Why aren't there more panels on rooftops? Some feel it should be mandatory, for instance, on all new industrial buildings. Would that work?
The government is already minded to try and encourage, as far as possible, preferential development on commercial rooftops and, you know, small to medium-sized enterprises like many farms. My own estimate is that there are at least 20,000 farm rooftop installations across the countryside. So this is by far the most popular option for very many farmers. But the constraints on whether you can actually retrofit a building, particularly once it's already in place, are determined by things like cable size. So it's very difficult to go back afterwards and say, oh, well, we could actually generate a lot more electricity than the buildings themselves need and export it, because you're going to be limited by the size of those cables. So one of the recommendations of the recent government solar roadmap actually was to engage a different formula when developing new large, out-of-town logistics warehouses and so on, in order to ensure that some of that potential that Jackie was talking about could then actually be implemented. But for the meantime, it is actually just a little simpler and easier to develop solar farms ground-mounted. Whether it is a farmer-led development of relatively small scale, or whether it is some of these extremely large, nationally significant infrastructure projects.
And Jackie, is that the issue here, actually? That when you're talking about size, when you want to do something relatively quickly, then it's easier to put it on the ground?
Yeah, well, that's the government's aim, its speed and cost. But CPRE would point out, in actual fact, we do recognise some solar will go on the ground, but we're concerned that we're having a grid upgrade at the moment, our transmission network, and what we're doing is we're upgrading it to remote parts of the country, Eastlands, and that happens to be where our fenlands and our best farmland is. And we would point out, well, why aren't we upgrading the grid to better serve urban conurbations in the north and the Midlands to enable more homes and more commercial properties to be able to take advantage? And we have been doing work with the UK Warehousing Association. Their members are crying out for more retrofit, having no or low interest loans. You know, there's a lot of interventions the government could make to actually make it easier for people to harness rooftop solar. And then, of course, if you've got solar, you can link it to heat pumps, you can link it to electric vehicle charging. The benefits are multiplied. So there's much more we could do. If you look at other countries, we did a piece of research in China, Japan, Poland, Italy, Germany. They're all racing ahead, harnessing wasted space. There are many examples. I love the example of Babysham in Shepton Mallet. They're in a conservation area. They didn't have a single objection to putting solar panels on, and they've saved about £3 million off their energy bills. So if the government wants to unlock clean energy and help businesses to grow, you know, there's a lot more that can be done.
We talk about this a lot on this programme because there's a lot of pressure on land. We want to use it for lots and lots of different things, like energy, wildlife, food production. The list goes on and on. So is perhaps the key to this doing more than one thing, perhaps two or three things, on the same bit of land? Three Valleys Farm near Bedford, they've got 20 acres of solar panels and around 10,000 free-range hens which roam around the panels. They produce both poultry and eggs. Well, here are Charlie and Laura Tompkins on how solar and poultry work alongside each other.
It was wired accordingly, and then there was certain chicken wire put around cables where they go into the inverters. The lease specifically says we're not allowed to graze certain animals in there that can cause trouble to cables and panels.
We've not had any negative issues doing poultry under panels, and in fact the egg inspector, they like the fact that it provides shade in the summer, and underneath the panels themselves you've got a different soil structure because not a lot grows there, so they can start having dust baths, which is all good for the chickens.
Jonathan, how common is this dual use of land?
Well, at the moment, good practice, which is strongly supported by the solar energy industry itself, encourages this kind of multi-purpose land use with grazing of small livestock, things like poultry or sheep, underneath the existing common structure of solar farms where everything is fixed tilt facing southwards. There are very interesting possibilities starting to emerge now, but not yet really adopted across the UK, so-called agrivoltaics, where the mounting system is more explicitly designed to offer greater flexibility in agricultural land use. So one possibility is slightly taller, more massive mounts, which can rotate from east to west, and it would then be possible to put dairy or beef cattle onto relatively good quality pasture, grazing underneath such solar arrays. Yet another configuration is to have bifacial solar fences running north-south across a field, spaced maybe about 8 to 10 metres apart, and allowing plenty of room for agricultural machinery to do things like cutting silage, again on good quality pasture land. You're getting essentially two functions from the same land.
How soon might that be a reality rather than a lovely idea?
Well, agrivoltaics is already being deployed in nearby countries like Germany, France and Italy. I think it's just a matter of time before it comes to the UK. That gift is really in the hands of the solar developers themselves. Let's just see who starts to implement this commercially first. I think there's an enormous public relations breakthrough to be had here, because if the general public can see land being used for more than just small livestock, then perhaps some of these objections about a perception of a threat to food security would go away. We know, of course, that there is at national level very little threat to food security because the total land take for solar is still so vanishingly small. But that's not necessarily how people perceive it at local level.
Jackie, from a CPRE point of view, would that go any way to solving some of your objections to the march of solar?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were very pleased that DEFRA this year published its land use framework, and that looks about stacking benefits from our land. You know, we anticipate 40% of solar would need to go on the ground because of the pace in which we need to achieve our climate targets. But there's many different examples of how doing it well, you can have community-led solar. We know of a South Hill Solar in Oxfordshire where the community have set up a relatively modest scale solar farm, and they have a community orchard, and they raise the funding through bonds, and it's been a really good success story. It blends into the landscape, they've allowed hedgerows to grow. And then other examples, Swatham Prior in East Cambridge, the local parish council, again a small ground-mounted scheme, but the whole village has come off oil and gone on to heat pumps, and they're all taking advantage of clean energy, cheaper bills. You know, 40 parish councils in the surrounding areas are saying, that's amazing, we want to have a part of that. But these decisions must be made with communities. If you do it against the will of the public, it's self-defeating. You're driving people away from supporting clean power. You must speak to the local communities to understand landscapes that are special, farmland that's best and most versatile, and where you can, avoid harms. And yes, deliver more community benefits. That's the other thing. These very large ones, they barely pay any community sums. And you look at the community-led ones, and the community payback is in spades. And that is not talking about these massive mega, it's talking about more socially responsible ways of harnessing clean energy.
Is the size one of the key ways of getting the community on board? Because in places like Lincolnshire or Cambridgeshire, the big solar developments that people object to, they really feel that those counties are taking more than their fair share. I heard that a lot in Lincolnshire, that why are all these farms here?
Yeah, that's
why are they?
You mentioned before about grid capacity, and clearly Lincolnshire, Nottinghamshire had coal-fired power stations, and so there is grid capacity, and that's one of the main thing. When we talk about scale, we're talking about, it's not just people living in villages who are objecting, it's the landscape experts of the local council saying, hang on a minute, this is a rural, predominantly rural area, and you're going to completely industrialise it with solar panels, because you don't just have the panels, you have large security fencing, you have lighting, so it definitely is more intrusive in the landscape when you have lots of very large sites clustered together. And so you can understand. And when you look at the map of people who are voting for parties that are anti-net zero, there's a linkage between people feeling frustrated and feeling unwelcoming of this. Particularly if you go into a village and you've got solar panels on all sides of the village, it's totally changing the nature of the place people live in.
You're listening to Farming Today this week here on BBC Radio 4. Today, discussing solar power. Our guests are Jonathan Scurlock, who is a renewable energy consultant, Jackie Copley, head of policy at the CPRE, the Campaign to Protect Rural England, and William Lachalas, a lecturer in rural land management at the Royal Agricultural University. William, when you're talking to your students who are going to become land agents advising farmers on all this, what do you advise them on the community aspect of this, the people bit, if you like?
That's a very interesting question, because a lot of what land agents do is about talking to people, about engaging with people. And it's those human skills, those soft skills are so important to bring, as Jackie was saying, the local community with you. It's a really complex area and something that we as educators are really trying to get to grips with our students, to bring them forward as professional people who will give impartial advice in a complex environment.
Well, let's look at an example of a solar development which has met strong local opposition. That's in Staffordshire, where many residents are up in arms about the effect of three solar farms planned for an area around Droynton. Opponents say they'll cover around 80% of the land in the area. Well, our reporter Bob Huckenhall spoke to David Gregory. He's fallen out with the farmer next door, who said yes to solar panels on his land.
I'm not happy at all. I mean, we're just virtually 100% surrounded by them, and no matter what direction we're looking, we're going to see panes of glass facing us. And it's just horrendous. This is a chap I went to school with, known all my life, and now we no longer speak and totally blank each other.
And how do you feel about that?
It's a shame.
Did they approach you at all?
Yes, but I'm in a small farm and my acreage wasn't big enough.
And would you have gone ahead with it?
No, definitely not. Very much opposed to them in that respect.
That's a community in Staffordshire split over solar development. The dairy farmer whose land's being leased for the solar farm told us he wasn't out to ruin the area. The solar farm was a way he could stay living in the area, have a holiday, have a life. Jonathan, how big a factor is local opinion when landowners are making these decisions? Or is it actually more down to a national land use plan?
One has to be rather careful in commenting upon individual planning cases. In some cases, you will get neighbour against neighbour. We have to recognise that the agricultural industry is a very broad church. Farmers don't necessarily speak with one voice. And we have been here before. For example, with onshore wind development, we have seen farmers falling out with their near neighbours because one farmer may be receiving a nice ground rent for hosting the turbine. The neighbour simply has to say, well, you've ruined my view because that thing's so obvious and I'm not receiving any income from it. So we would see the same kind of thing with solar, except perhaps that solar is much less obvious in the landscape. So while some people may feel threatened that they're going to be surrounded by unfamiliar looking structures in fields, in many cases at eye level you really don't actually see very much because they are screened by high hedges if they're responsibly installed on relatively level ground.
Although some of our listeners say it's a horrible thing to look at, and also it won't work in the winter, it won't be an all-round resource, so what's the point?
The cost per kilowatt hour of electricity from solar is now among the lowest anywhere in the world. That is why the industry is growing so quickly. Clearly, it doesn't generate at night, and about 75% of your solar output in Britain is received between about March and October, and only a quarter between October and March. So you often would need to compensate for that. But in many cases, individual farmers or at national level, significant amounts of what would otherwise be fossil fuel, dirty, carbon intensive generation is being displaced by clean power.
Jackie, the CPRE regularly voices its concerns about these sorts of developments. How much of this can be dismissed as a NIMBY argument? You know, renewables are great, I just don't want to have to look at them over the hedge.
We have to take a reasonable view. And I said before that we are accepting some will go on the ground, but we just like it to follow better principles, and therefore you would avoid such objection. I think if you have been raised and live your life or gone and retired to a particular area and you have done so because you want to be surrounded by tranquil countryside, and then you find out actually all of your landscapes are going to be covered in solar panels. And whilst there are some methods of designing sites so they fit into the landscape, but actually a lot of panels are becoming taller and they actually can change angles. So when they're these massive ones, they have a very prominent impact on the landscape. And I don't think it's fair just to sideline somebody's view saying that they're a NIMBY. It's used a lot, but, you know, people's quality of life are being impacted, and part of England's iconic countryside is the way it looks, pastoral landscapes, and there are some landscapes that are more degraded or urban than others, so we need to be sensible about the way we do it. And I think those farmers that want to proceed should be looking at rooftops and dairy sheds first, and then look at poorer quality land that's not yielding the same amounts of food. So, you know, and that's more sensible. I think people can understand that.
Just before we end, I wonder if I can put a question to all three of you. Will this summer, because it's been so sunny and also so difficult for farmers, both livestock farmers and those growing arable crops, will this be a turning point when we look at solar panels in the countryside? William, what do you think?
I think it's just going to increase the farmers' determination to look at alternative sources of income. Solar is just a form of diversification for many landowners to find alternative income to supplement stroke replace agricultural incomes that used to be very strong and provide a very good livelihood. And farmers see themselves first and foremost in the main as food producers.
Jackie, what do you think?
Well, I think the summer we've just had really puts the matter into sharp focus, and I think climate deniers out there, you know, they just need to get a grip, really. We have got challenges in rural areas from flooding, droughts, extreme heats, and we all need to get on board and support the government. But CPRE just wants to have the majority, the lion's share of solar should be aimed at waste of space. It shouldn't go on farmland.
Jonathan?
I think that summer 2026 will be seen as a bit of a turning point. And frankly, there are even more severe impacts to come. We're just hearing from the Met Office about a particularly strong El Nino impact in terms of global climate. So we can expect perhaps, you know, some stress from rainfall and flooding over the winter, and then maybe another severely dry summer to come after that, so-called climate whiplash, where things are flipping from one state to another. And in response to this, public and decision makers will probably see that, yes, you know, we are now facing a climate emergency. Urgent action needs to be taken. The UK still has an opportunity to demonstrate leadership in rapidly decarbonising both our electricity supply and then all the other parts of the economy.
Well, thank you. That sadly is all we have time for. Thank you very much to our guests, Jackie Copley from the CPRE, the renewable energy consultant Jonathan Scurlock, and William Lachalas from the Royal Agricultural University. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Rebecca Rooney, and Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
And just a reminder that if you've missed any editions of Farming Today from the last few days, and indeed from the last few weeks, you'll find them available to listen to now on BBC Sounds. Now, with an update on the weather, here's Sarah Keith-Lucas.
Thank you, Alan. Well, after a fairly unsettled few days where we've had some welcome rainfall at times, high pressure is now building as we head through the rest of the weekend. And that is going to keep the weather mostly dry, fairly settled. There'll be some sunshine in the forecast, just a few isolated showers, and temperatures are gradually going to creep up by a few degrees during today and into tomorrow as well. So to start off, across England and Wales, then, most places dry. We've got a few rogue showers around across North Wales, also one or two close to the coast, so East Yorkshire, Lincolnshire, Norfolk, also catching a few of those showers. The showers in most places will ease as we move through the day, just a risk of perhaps one or two for South West England later on. Cloud will bubble up, so I think it'll be sunny spells rather than wall-to-wall sunshine, but a fine day, light winds away from the east coast where it's a little bit breezy, and top temperatures across England and Wales between about 19 to 23. For Scotland and Northern Ireland, again, most places going to be dry, but there will be some showers feeding in, particularly to the northwest of Scotland on a northwesterly breeze, one or two around the north coast of Northern Ireland too. But most other places looking dry with some sunshine, and temperatures across Scotland and Northern Ireland between 16 to 18. Then as we move through this evening and overnight, again dry for the vast majority, still a feed of showers coming in across parts of the northwest of Scotland, perhaps into the north of Northern Ireland as well. But further south, you've got clear spells and one or two misty patches forming through the night. Temperatures in the north holding up between about 9 to 12, where we've got a bit more cloud. But further south, under the clear skies, a fairly chilly night. We could get down to around 6 or 7 degrees. Tomorrow looks like a similar day to today, but I think fewer showers, just one or two rogue ones again for the northwest of Scotland, perhaps around the east coast of England tomorrow too. But a little bit more sunshine tomorrow compared to today, particularly in the south, and we'll see temperatures a touch higher. So highs tomorrow around about 19 to 21 in the north, 22 to 24 in the south, mostly dry too into Monday, then more unsettled into the middle of the coming week. Alan.
Thanks, Sarah. We'll join the Today programme in a minute. That's after a look ahead to later on this morning.
Wild Mountain Time has always been a favourite of mine.
The new series of Soul Music on BBC Radio 4.
It's an expression of love. We don't know what tomorrow holds.
The pieces of music that touch people's lives.
The song, you know, composed by Edvard Grieg is one of the national treasures of Norway.
Suddenly you get this da 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 and you get this impulse.
Soul Music continues on Saturday mornings at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker. This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Saturday the 22nd of August. This is Today with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
The headlines this morning, TikTok has agreed to pay $400 million in the United States in what's being described as one of the largest child privacy settlements in history. We'll be asking what it tells us about campaigners' attempts to hold social media companies to account through the courts. And the economist Lord O'Neill says he's not taking a job in the government, despite being widely expected to work under Andy Burnham. I'll be talking to him after 8 o'clock.
Also in today's programme, concerns are growing about the safety risks posed by e-bikes.
One of them held up the traffic doing wheelies. The other one chased me down. Before you know it, I'm on the side of the road. I went flying. I was cut out of my clothing, put on a stretcher and a pelvic brace.
So should we be doing more to regulate their use? Ukrainian strikes on Russia are squeezing petrol supplies.
I'm outside a petrol station. I have to say I've never seen queues for petrol in the Russian capital as long as this. The road leading up to the petrol station is absolutely packed with cars. I've counted about 60 and they keep coming.
As ordinary Russians feel the pinch at the pumps, our attitudes towards Vladimir Putin starting to change. And the perpetual underdog Wile E. Coyote has finally won the day and made it to the big screen after Warner Brothers wrote off the film for tax purposes.
You won, haven't you?
We haven't been splat yet at the bottom of the canyons. We're taking that as a win.
Good morning from Mike Williams with your Saturday Sport. Arsenal begin the defence of their Premier League title with a 3-0 win over newly promoted Coventry City. England's cricketers wrap up a comprehensive victory over Pakistan inside 3 days. And coming up, we will look ahead to the final day of racing's Ebor Festival at York.
Before all of that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Alan Smith.
The video sharing app TikTok has agreed to pay $400 million, the equivalent of £293 million, after being accused in the United States of violating children's online privacy. The US Justice Department called the settlement a major victory for parents and their children, saying they were safer now than when the case began. Our North America technology correspondent Lily Jamali reports.
This agreement is being called one of the largest child privacy settlements in history. The lawsuit was brought by the U.S. Department of Justice in 2024 when Joe Biden was president. The department alleged TikTok and its parent company ByteDance collected vast amounts of data on millions of users under the age of 13, including names and email addresses. TikTok had been accused of violating the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, a federal law known as COPPA. That same law is the one several U.S. states allege that Meta has violated, which it denies. That case is currently being heard by a court in California. YouTube and the Fortnite maker Epic Games have also reached settlements over alleged breaches of COPPA. A representative for TikTok contacted for comment by the BBC did not respond.
The Economist's Lord O'Neill says he will not be taking a job in Andy Burnham's government. He'd been advising the Prime Minister and previously served as a Treasury Minister under the Conservatives. More details from our political correspondent David Cornock.
Jim O'Neill, a former chief economist at Goldman Sachs, had been tipped to become the Prime Minister's chief economic adviser. But as first reported by the Financial Times, he's decided not to take a government job. He said he was enjoying what he's currently doing too much and didn't want to have to give up control of his business interests to comply with official rules. The crossbench peer stressed his decision was not due to policy disagreements, and he was a massive fan of Andy Burnham's focus on devolution. He said he hoped the Prime Minister and his team would be bold and to maintain an informal relationship with them.
The United States has imposed 50% tariffs on some Canadian goods after last-ditch trade talks between the two countries failed to reach an agreement. The duties cover 5.5% of total exports from to the US from Canada and include products from cement to hockey sticks. The Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney pledged to match the tariffs dollar for dollar. BBC News has been told the Duchess of Sussex is in talks to appear in a TV series being made by Netflix. There's been speculation that a return to her former acting career is one of the reasons Meghan and Prince Harry are moving back to the UK with their young children. Here's our senior royal correspondent, Daniela Relf.
The BBC has learnt that the Duchess of Sussex is in talks to appear in the Netflix series The Gentleman, created by the British film director Guy Ritchie. Discussions are in their early stages, but this would be the first significant acting role for Meghan since her marriage to Prince Harry. The Gentleman is a comedy series about a duke who becomes a drug baron. Much of the two previous series of the show have been filmed in the Cotswolds, close to where it's rumoured Harry and Meghan will set up home in the UK. Although the details of a possible role for Meghan have not been revealed, it's becoming increasingly clear that her return to acting has been an important part of the family decision to come back to the UK.
A six-year-old girl who was rescued from the water off the coast of West Sussex on Tuesday has died in hospital. Saja Al-Khawas's mother, father and older sister Sarah all died during the incident in Shoreham. Here's our UK correspondent Daniel Sanford.
It was on Tuesday afternoon that four members of the British-Palestinian family from London got into difficulty in the water near the Old Fort. There was a huge emergency response involving a lifeboat, the Coast Guard, ambulances, police and helicopters. Despite the rescue efforts, Hassan Al-Khawas, his wife Zaina Elaine and their 14-year-old daughter Sarah all died. Her younger sister, 6-year-old Saja, survived and was taken to hospital in a critical condition. But Sussex police have confirmed that she has now also died. The force said that after looking at CCTV footage and talking to eyewitnesses, they currently think the deaths were a tragic accident.
Ukraine says at least two people have been killed in the latest Russian strikes on the capital Kyiv and the southern city of Zaporizhia. The number of dead after drones hit a shopping centre in Kryvyi Rih yesterday has risen to 16. President Trump says he's grateful for a US Supreme Court ruling that means construction of a White House ballroom can carry on for now. A challenge against the project is being heard by lower courts. This report from our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman.
President Trump ordered the demolition of the White House's historic East Wing last year, beginning construction of a massive ballroom he said would be the greatest of its kind ever built. The legal challenge came from the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Today's ruling from the Supreme Court doesn't address the legality of the project, which two other courts had said was unlawful because Congress hadn't approved it. Rather, it is meant to give the justices more time to consider Mr. Trump's request. In the meantime, construction can continue on the ballroom, involving a 250-person crew working 20-hour days, 7 days a week, which Mr. Trump argues is also a security necessity owing to the project's underground bunkers and anti-drone protections.
The NHS in England says hot temperatures this summer have led to a surge in the number of people reporting insect bites and stings. Those affected are being urged to seek help from pharmacists who can provide treatments such as antihistamines and steroid creams. Rebecca Drought reports.
The number of people in England who went to hospital because of an insect or spider bite was more than 1,200 in May, more than double the almost 500 the previous month. The number of visits to the NHS website for advice also soared, from 90,000 in June to almost 122,000 in July. The National Medical Director at NHS England, Professor Frankie Swords, says bites and stings aren't unusual in the summer. She says pharmacists can offer treatments, including, if appropriate, the same ones as a GP for an infected bite. Last week, the NHS said there'd been a record 2.5 million A&E attendances in July.
The FBI has returned 48 looted antiquities to Egypt after an investigation into an alleged trafficking operation. The objects, spanning thousands of years of Egyptian history, were handed over at a ceremony in Los Angeles, from where our North America correspondent Shaima Khalil reports.
Carved figures, amulets and objects once placed inside ancient tombs are among the artifacts which have been handed back to Egypt. The 48 pieces date from the Pharaonic, Roman and Coptic periods. The FBI in Los Angeles says experts confirmed they'd been illegally removed from the country, but the investigation remains open as agents search for possible accomplices and other missing treasures. The operation is part of an agreement signed by Washington and Cairo in 2016, designed to stop trafficked antiquities entering America and help send stolen objects home. The FBI says trafficking antiquities isn't simply the theft of a country's history. It can also help fund international criminal and terrorist organizations.
The opening night of the Premier League season has seen the reigning champions Arsenal record a 3-0 win. They defeated Coventry, who were playing their first top-flight match in 25 years. The Coventry manager, Frank Lampard, said his side deserved to lose.
It was a good lesson for the boys. Did we play with Finn? No, but were we a little bit apprehensive from our normal game? Yeah, in the first half, and maybe that happens against high level with, I think, 7 or 8 Premier League debuts in our team.
That was the Coventry manager, Frank Lampard.
Thank you for that. 7:10 is the time. Let's have our first look at the papers and a wide range of stories on the front pages. Let's pick two of them, or shall I start by picking two of them? The first of them, relevant to our 8:10 interview today. So Jim O'Neill, a pro-business voice, as the Financial Times puts it on its front page, is not going to be taking a formal role in Andy Burnham's government. The FT says, and it's its main story, that he's declined that role, and that he's no longer going to be economic advisor or chief economic advisor to Andy Burnham. Lord O'Neill has made it clear he opposes higher taxes on wealth and business, particularly a rising capital gains tax, and might have quit had Burnham adopted them, the FT says. But it also says that actually he says he doesn't want the job, Jim O'Neill, because he doesn't want the constraints of putting his financial interests into a blind trust. So there's no policy difference at the moment with Andy Burnham. But, of course, with the budget not that far away, it is a hugely important story. And he will be here at 8:10 to tell us, and indeed to tell you, why he's not taking the job. Another interesting story on the front page of The Guardian, also about money. This about MPs, or at least backbench MPs. MPs accused of failing to learn the lesson over freebies, The Guardian says, after taking almost £400,000 of hospitality to concerts and sporting events. They give some examples. The Chelsea Flower Show, tickets worth £1,839 from Lloyds Bank Group for Wes Streeting. Louise Haig, Andy Burnham's deputy, taking a ticket worth £1,314 to the Ivor Novello Awards, and quite a few other kind of huge amounts to go to things. All of these people, though, The Guardian does make plain, were backbench MPs when they accepted the hospitality. They have only more recently been elevated to cabinet jobs under Andy Burnham, but The Guardian does not think much of them or the other MPs taking the money.
Speaking of MPs, or nearly MPs, your friend Count Binface is unmasked in the Times magazine today. The man inside the suit has done an interview with them. I won't spoil the surprise. I'll let you read that one yourself later on. And, of course, Harry and Meghan, their return to the UK, dominating several of the front pages this morning. The Daily Mail, as you might expect, leads on that news yesterday that Prince Harry, Sir Elton John and various others will have to pay a large amount of money to Associated Newspapers, the owner of the Mail, over that court case that they lost. Prince and other claimants face up to £34.5 million bill for court costs, says the Mail this morning. And on the return to the UK front, we were talking on the programme yesterday about a potential acting job for Meghan in the UK, which might have been one of the motivating reasons behind that move. It seems this morning that it is a Guy Ritchie series on Netflix called The Gentleman, the third series of that, which she may well have landed a role in. We will wait and see, won't we?
30 minutes past seven.
A big story overnight, which hasn't made the papers this morning, just breaking in the last couple of hours, is that TikTok is paying nearly £300 million to settle a lawsuit with the US government, which was suing it over claims it violated children's privacy by collecting their personal details, things like names and email addresses. The video app's parent company, ByteDance, said it had developed sophisticated systems to tackle under-13s who misrepresented their age when they were signing up. But the US Justice Department said actually its case was what had left young people and their parents better protected in all of this. Lily Jamali is our North America tech correspondent. Lily, first of all, just bring us up to date with this settlement that that ByteDance has made with the US government.
Yeah, so it's the equivalent of about $400 million. So there will be a $300 million payment being made by TikTok to the U.S. government up front. And then there's also this sort of residual case from back in 2019. An agreement had been brokered between what became TikTok, what was then called Musical.ly, and the American government, where basically they're trying to, at that time, the concern was, again, protecting kids' data. There was a violation there. And so in order to kind of vacate that deal, the company is going to pay yet another $100 million. It's being called one of the largest recoveries ever obtained in a case having to do with COPPA, this law passed many years ago now, that's the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act.
Yeah, tell us a bit more about that, Lily. It was enacted in 2000, this federal law. It seems somewhat forward-thinking now, but it is the mechanism by which various companies are being challenged in court at the moment.
That's right, including Meta, which is the maker of Instagram and Facebook. Just this past week, we've been in a courthouse in Oakland, California, where a number of American states are bringing a case against that company, in part on the grounds that they believe Meta violated this same law, COPPA. And they say that Meta harvested the data of children under the age of 13 without their parental consent. This law, you know, we often hear how America, the U.S. has no federal privacy law. Well, there is this one having to do with children, and it's not just Meta that's in court now. We've seen Epic Games, which is the maker of Fortnite, as well as Google pay fines because of settlements made to settle claims brought under this law in the past as well.
And just a brief thought, Lily, that the companies, amid all of this, various court filings, they are saying that they are doing everything that they can within their power, they say, to protect children. Is this likely to change the way that we all use social media?
Well, you know, a lot of people will say that these companies cannot be trusted to police themselves. Certainly, there are plenty of critics in that camp. When you see this type of settlement by the federal government, you see the case brought by the states, I think that does put other companies on notice, other companies in this space, that they either need to self-correct or, you know, a lot of them are actually involved in various legal actions themselves. Taken together, I do think there's a bigger wave happening that could result in a different experience for all of us on social media over time. But these cases sometimes take years to make their way through. And so this one was filed back in 2024. Here we are 2 years later. But it's just one of many cases making their way through the courts and through the system right now.
Yeah, we'll consider this a little more through the programme this morning. Lily Jamali, our North America tech correspondent. Thank you.
17 minutes past seven. Ebola is still causing suffering in the Democratic Republic of Congo and indeed growing there at a great pace, according to the UN. They draw particular attention to the deaths of healthcare workers and to attacks on them by some local people. Julian Harness is the UN's Ebola senior coordinator in Bunia in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is the epicentre of the outbreak, and is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Give us a sense of the scale of what is happening.
So the epidemic is growing exponentially. There's more than 2,500 people have died in the last 3 months, and half of those was just in the last 20 days. So it's the cases are rocketing up, and it's spreading wide. It's now into six provinces, an area that is bigger than France, to give a comparison, and all of that faster than our ability to respond.
And your ability to respond, or the world's ability to respond, is hampered presumably by the difficulties of operating in this area, but also hampered, it seems, by people not wanting to accept the things that they are advised to do.
Totally correct. There's a lot of people out here who do want care. There are a lot of people who are coming in for care, but there is absolutely a minority of people who are resisting and sometimes violently. We've seen attacks against ambulances stoned, burned, health facilities damaged, including several burnt and destroyed, and attacks against health workers. Now, I must stress this is a minority, and this is generally in remote areas outside of Bunia City, but obviously it's disruptive. And it's incredibly tough on some very brave health workers who are working under very difficult conditions, and many of whom have been infected by Ebola themselves, and more than 40 have died.
And when you say difficult conditions, I mean difficult anyway, even without Ebola, to operate in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Yes, completely. The Ituri is a beautiful part of the Congo with, again, amazing people, but it is a part of Congo which has been affected by different conflicts continuously since 1999. And that undermines the state basic social services. It means that basic things like roads are not up to the standard that's necessary for this vast area. Just to give an example, 3 days ago, I drove 50 miles and it took us 3 hours because we had to drive through the mud, the potholes. And that's very typical of getting around in much of Ituri. So you've got a whole series of complicating issues for the response.
Is there a vaccine on the way?
There is a vaccine which was used on a previous strain of Ebola, not this strain, which is undergoing trials. The first vaccines arrived yesterday in Kinshasa, and they will be deployed. They'll be used for trials, and they will be used for health workers. Now, we need to stress that this is not specific to the Bundibugyo strain, and we know it's safe, but we don't yet know its efficacy.
Well, all the best to you and to the other people trying their best to contain the outbreak. Julian Harness in Democratic Republic of Congo. Thank you.
It's 21 minutes past seven now. It has been a soggy few days, it's fair to say, weather-wise, for many of us, after weeks of baking heat and drought. And although for many the rain has been a welcome arrival, the fact that it doesn't do a great deal to improve the situation when it comes to properly hydrating the ground or topping up water reserves is a real problem. And given that the weather this summer is likely to become more common and that unprecedented El Nino event on the way will have a huge effect on the world's climate next year, is now the time to be thinking more carefully and strategically about the way that we use water? Well, Dr. Jess Neumann joins us, Associate Professor of Hydrology at the University of Reading, and George Eustace, who's a former Conservative Environment Secretary, now runs a consultancy whose clients have included firms in the water supply chain. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Neumann, to you first of all, just I suppose it's worth laying out, isn't it, what are our problems are here quite how and why we're not storing water as efficiently as we should?
Well, there's numerous things that are at play here, not least that we're seeing more extreme weather. So this sort of flip-flopping from very, very wet winters to extremely hot, dry summers by UK standards. And then, of course, we've got or had massive underinvestment in our water infrastructure. So lots of blame being sort of laid at the feet of water companies, but also just our approach to how we manage our water. You know, we have a very clear sort of idea that water is abundant, that we can turn on the tap and fresh water will just be there. So we've never really worked to store water or work with it in ways that perhaps other Mediterranean countries have had to, for example.
And what could we do? Is there anything that was within our grasp, Jess, to do now and quite quickly to turn that around?
Well, we're hearing a lot of narrative around just build more reservoirs or we just need to fix the leaks. And of course, that is one or two ways of a very much integrated approach that 100% need to be done. But personally, I think we're really going to have to look towards more local level solutions, you know, new housing developments. Why are they not being built with, you know, the climate and the water crisis in mind? Why are we still often putting in combined sewer systems where our rainfall just mixes with our, you know, dirty water pipes, and then we have problems with sewage overflow? We're not storing our rainwater adequately. There could be small localized storage, natural flood management, small reservoirs, all of these with pumps that allow water recycling back into, you know, watering our gardens or flushing our toilets. Why are we doing that with fresh water? So that's definitely an area that I think we really, really need to be investing heavily in.
Mm. And why hasn't that investment happened, George Eustace? And successive governments over many years, and as Jess was saying there, that underinvestment, particularly in the infrastructure of the water system, why has it been ignored for so long?
Well, the reality is that every government since at least the financial crisis and possibly sooner has been very conscious about the impacts of the cost of living and the impacts on household bills. So that has been a factor. And that's why in pretty much every strategic policy statement that governments from Labour to Coalition to Conservative gave water companies over that 20-year period, often it was about trying to contain bills. And the second thing linked to that is a lot of the technical advice that I would get as a minister and others too, is that rather than building huge new reservoirs, which are a big cost, it was seen as a more cost-effective way to improve connectivity between reservoirs. So in some areas of the country, particularly Yorkshire, a lot was done to connect up the different reservoirs to improve resilience so that water could be available. They created a sort of localized water grid that was seen as very effective. And there were attempts to do that in other parts of the country. And since about 2018 or 19, there's been a lot of emphasis on trying to connect water catchments. So there's been talk of a connector, for instance, to move water from the Severn, which is usually quite abundant in water, down to the Thames, which is water stressed. So a lot of the emphasis has been on connectivity between our water network rather than the very high cost of building new reservoirs, which, you know, a lot of the technical advice said that was a less necessary move. But I think from where we are now, we probably do need to build more reservoirs. We need to commit to do that. And I think we need to look at the right funding model for that. It probably shouldn't be what we've done traditionally through asset management plans with water companies. We need to look at the model that we had with the Thames Tideway Tunnel, where you can have big infrastructure projects funded slightly separately, funded slightly outside the water companies, where you can get the cost of capital down. And that's the kind of thing the government should be looking at, in my view.
Are we going far too easy on the water companies? Because they are not spending the money that they need to spend on improving that infrastructure and their profits. You look at Thames Water, so many problems at that company, but still profits rising by 39%. Anglian Water, its operating profit increased by 28% to £636 million in the last year. And people will look at that and say, why isn't that money being spent on improving these very clear and obvious problems?
Well, look, these are very highly regulated sectors. Yes, look, of course, water companies have got an absolute role to play in this, and a lot of the criticism against them is justified. But equally, particularly in this area, you know, they will only invest what their asset management plan allows them to. So roughly every 5 years, there is a discussion between Ofwat, the regulator, and each water company about what they're able to build and how much the regulator will allow water bills to rise to finance that. And they're constrained by that. And to be fair to them, many of them had been saying they were willing and ready to invest more. But the regulator, in some ways, was holding them back. And they were doing so because governments were conscious about the impact on household bills. So I don't think you can completely blame the water companies. And of course, the other thing is, the great paradox in some ways, when you have a drought like we have now, those physical conditions underground where it dries out actually leads to a very sharp increase in leaks. And so people find it incredulous that they're being told to have a hose pipe ban when they see lots of leaks happening. But sadly, when you get drought conditions, the number of leaks tends to increase by about 50%. So you get more leaks just when you don't need them. And to be fair, a lot of there's engineers from water companies out there in the sweltering heat digging up the ground.
But from a public point of view, when people are being told by organisations like Ofwat, for example, you know, people in Asian communities being told not to wash their rice in as much water, for example, people being told to turn the tap off when they're brushing their teeth, but then they see these leaks, as Dr. Neumann pointed out there, and as you pointed out as well, and those not being fixed. It's very difficult, isn't it, for the water companies to try and get people to change their behaviour when that's what they're seeing around them?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the big challenges you have in these drought situations. I mean, every water company for 20 years has had a drought plan in place, and they have water resource management plans in place, and they follow those. And a lot of planning goes into if summers like we've just seen. But yes, it's a real challenge because of the optics for it for the public. When they see leaks, they think, well, why should I abide by a water hose pipe ban? But the difficulty is for those water companies, they're facing a real dilemma as well, because the very conditions that give us drought also happen to be conditions that typically lead to a 50% increase in leaks. And if you look at a company like Thames Water, they're currently fixing around 1,000 leaks per week. And that's, you know, typically in a year like this, 20 to 30% higher than it previously would have been. So they are doing their best in these difficult situations as well. It's not to say that they're not culpable to some extent, but ultimately the reality here is the regulator has constrained their ability to invest. It's done it because different governments of all colours have been conscious about the impact on public bills, and also advised that improving connectivity between reservoirs was a more cost-effective way to go.
Okay. Look, thank you both. Appreciate your time this morning, George Eustace and Dr. Jess Neumann.
7:30, time for the sport. Here's Mike.
Justin, thank you. The Premier League champions are off and running for the new season.
The cross in the Havertz, Arsenal lead. The opening goal of the Premier League campaign comes 14 minutes into this match at the Emirates. No ball, looks for Saka. It'll come to him. It's two. Weight on the overlap. Beautiful weight on the pass. The ball back to Odegaard. He stuffed the shot. It's in.
Yes, goals from Kai Havertz, Bukayo Saka in the first half and Martin Odegaard in the second handed Mikel Arteta's Arsenal a comfortable 3-0 win over Coventry.
We're going to keep the demands at that level. We've got the squad, the quality in the team with individuals to do that. Today, I think there were some incredible performances individually as well, which you need at this level, and we will try to raise the level.
The opening weekend of the Premier League continues later today. Another newly promoted side, Hull City, host Manchester United in the early kickoff. That's at 12:30. Later on, you can hear Nottingham Forest against Leeds on 5 Live Sport from 3 p.m. In cricket, the England captain Joe Root praised his side's execution yesterday after they stormed to victory in the first test against Pakistan at Headingley. Inside 3 days, England won by an innings and 103 runs.
I don't think they quite know how good they are just yet, but the more they can perform like that and we can back up performances like that very quickly, I think they'll start to realise and prove to themselves what they're capable of doing at this level.
It is England's 7th consecutive win at Headingley. The second test starts at Lords on Thursday. We now, though, are going to talk racing because the prestigious Ebor Festival concludes this afternoon at York. We can have a quick chat to the racing journalist, Frank Keogh, who's been in York this week. Hi, Frank.
Hi there, Mike.
Plenty of stories over the first 3 days at the Ebor, hasn't there? What's been the highlights of the week for you?
I think the success of Andrew Balding, the trainer. He's had six winners this week. And it'll be well known, I guess, to Radio 4 listeners because he's the brother of younger brother of Claire Balding. So his horse, Item, won the Judmont International. Item's the son of the legendary racehorse Frankel. And Kalpana won the Yorkshire Oaks, two big top-level Group 1 races that he took this week.
And it all finishes today, as we say, the Ebor Handicap, the feature race. What should we look out for there?
Right, so they're expecting a crowd of 27,000 today. I should say the going, that's officially good to soft, good in places. It should be dry there today with sunny spells. The Ebor, as you say, that has a £500,000 in prize money. If you win that race, you get an entry for the Melbourne Cup in November. That's so big, Robbie Williams is actually playing before racing. And the favourite today is a horse trained by Willie Mullins called Love Me Tender. And I guess Andrew Balding will hoping that he could be all shook up by his two runners, which are called Tarriance and Fervor.
And just as a final, more general point, Frank, they do call the Ebor Festival the Royal Ascot of the North, don't they? But it is also perhaps true to say that, that this week doesn't have quite as high a profile as its southern counterpart. But you, I'm sure, can attest, having been there this week, that these 4 days really matter, don't they, to the race-loving public of the North of England.
I guess people up here would call Ascot the York of the South. I think they both stand in their own right. Ascot welcomes, I think, nearly 300,000 people over the 5 days in June. So York is not as big as that, but it certainly the quality of the racing and also the atmosphere there. It's such a kind of relaxed vibe and people are very friendly. And I think it kind of stands in its own right, really, Mike.
Well, enjoy the final day up in York, and we should leave you with some tips for the final day of the Ebor Festival. Our first comes in the 2:25. We go with number 7, My Ballyquin, and then in the feature race, the Ebor, the big one, at 3:35. Our selection is number 6, Tarriance. And just to say, away from racing, Formula One returns this weekend after its summer break. You can hear commentary of the sprint race for the Dutch Grand Prix from 11 a.m. over on BBC Sounds.
Thank you, Mike. Here's Paddy O'Connell with details of tomorrow's broadcasting house.
Hello. Shipbuilding is returning to the yard which built the Titanic. We report from Harland and Wolff in Belfast. We speak to the mayor of Como in Italy, who's banned bikes from key streets there after he was knocked to the floor by an electric one.
I heard like a noise. It was like a bee coming and I was on the floor.
Do we here need a checkup on how we all use the road and the pavement? Why can't we all just get along? Share your view on BH at bbc.co.uk. We're on BBC Sounds from 9 tomorrow morning and here, where it all began, on BBC Radio 4.
You don't have to wait till then, actually, to talk about e-bikes. We're about to do that in a few minutes' time. But first, you're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Justin Webb in London, and at 25 to 8, Alan Smith with the news.
TikTok has agreed to pay $400 million, the equivalent of £293 million, to settle a US lawsuit in which it was accused of violating children's privacy online. The lawsuit claimed names and email addresses were gathered by the video sharing app. The US Justice Department said the outcome was a major victory for parents and their children. TikTok has not responded for a request for comment. The economist Lord O'Neill says he will not be taking a job in Andy Burnham's government. The former Conservative Treasury Minister had been tipped to become Mr. Burnham's chief economic adviser, but said he didn't want to have to give up control of his business interests to comply with official rules. The United States has imposed 50% tariffs on some Canadian goods after trade talks between the two countries failed to reach an agreement. The duties cover 5.5% of total exports to the US from Canada. The Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney pledged to match the tariffs dollar for dollar. The BBC News has been told the Duchess of Sussex is in talks to appear in the Netflix series The Gentleman. There's been speculation that a return to her former acting career is one of the reasons Meghan and Prince Harry are moving back to the UK with their young children. A six-year-old girl who was rescued from the water off the coast of West Sussex on Tuesday has died in hospital. Saja El-Khawasi's mother, father and older sister Sarah all died at the scene during the accident in Shoreham. Police say evidence so far suggests that it was a tragic accident. The FBI has returned 48 artifacts to Egypt after an investigation confirmed they had been illegally removed from the country. The items, including carved figures and amulets, were handed over at a ceremony in Los Angeles.
Thank you for that, Alan. 23 minutes to 8 is the time. What can be done then about e-bikes, those hugely powerful electric bikes that seem often to be ridden by people wearing masks and up to no good? Some of them are legal, but some modified illegally to go faster. All of them can pose a danger, of course, to pedestrians on pavements, but also to others on the road. Taylor is in his early 20s. A few months ago, he was riding to work on his motorbike when he found himself in some trouble.
Broad daylight, it's about 11 a.m. One of them held up the traffic, doing wheelies, weaving and stuff, stopping anyone from getting past. The other one chased me down. Before you know it, I'm on the side of the road. I went flying. Ambulance was called. I was cut out of my clothing, put on a stretcher and a pelvic brace. Yeah, I was left laying there. Bike was all flipped upside down and they just went on about their day.
Let's talk to Tony Campbell, who's chief executive of the Motorcycle Industry Association, and to Donna Jones as well, who's the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Police and Crime Commissioner. Morning to you both. Tony Campbell, first of all, just explain to us what is legal and what is illegal.
Well, a legal e-bike, so we'll talk about the e-bike first. So an e-bike sits in a set of regulations called the electric pedal assisted cycle. So that's from a road vehicle perspective, that's considered a bicycle. Now, to qualify within that regulation, it has to be a maximum of 250 watt pedal assistance, and the pedal assistance must cut off at 15.5 mile an hour. Of course, the rider can exceed those speeds by pedaling faster, but there should be no power assistance to enable the vehicle to be propelled by the motor beyond that power level. Traditionally, obviously, they look very much like a push bike with a battery. Anything that performs or has a higher power rating beyond those levels that I've just explained, that would then fall into the motorcycle category, which is the L category regulatory framework for mopeds, motorcycles and other types of vehicles in that category.
Right. And for that, you'd need a helmet and insurance and all the rest of it. Yeah.
Yeah, correct. Once the vehicle's performing beyond those levels I've just explained, then technically the vehicle should be insured, should be registered, should meet with the regulation, and the rider should have the necessary license and be wearing a motorcycle standard crash helmet.
Yeah. And if people just follow the law, Donna Jones, that's pretty clear, isn't it? If the law was being followed, is that acceptable?
Here, absolutely. If the law was being followed, fine. But a lot of these bikes, these Suron bikes, for example, some of them are going in excess of 40, 50 miles an hour because they've been modified. It's very, very difficult for the police to catch them. So whilst they have powers to seize and crush these bikes, if they are modified and they're being used, particularly in connection with crime as well, it's actually physically catching these people. They're off through alleyways, through parks, through housing estates. So if a police officer is on a normal e-bike, a pedal bike with a small battery power on it, they can't keep up with these. Now, I've bought in my force some off-road dirt bike type motorbikes, unmarked, so that the police can pursue. But you have to be incredibly careful, because the way that you stop someone on one of these bikes is like a tactical hit if you're trying to stop a car. And you know, it does take bravery from the police officers. It takes a special amount of skill. We don't have enough police officers that are skilled to do that across all of our towns and bigger towns and cities where these bikes are an issue. So there really is a significant problem here that the government really need to be supporting towns and communities
well,
in.
What more do they need to do? Because they've told us, we've strengthened police power so that officers no longer need to issue a warning before seizing legal vehicles, illegal vehicles, I suppose they mean, where they are used antisocially.
Well, I think it's about education. You can buy these things online. You can buy them in some high street stores. And because of that, people who are buying them for their children, for example, don't actually realise that they are encouraging their young person to break the law. It's exactly the same with an electric scooter. You know, if you are using a proper electric scooter through a hire scheme through your local town or city council, that's not a problem. But if you're buying one from a high street store or on, you know, online, and giving it to your child for birthday, Christmas, whatever it might be, you are actually encouraging your child to commit a crime, to effectively become a criminal, because it's illegal to use these scooters. So my issue here is a lack of education, that the Department for Transport must be running an education program like they did back in the 80s with the clunk, click, every trip wearing a seatbelt. People need to realise that they are breaking the law or encouraging their children to break the law if they buy these bikes and scooters.
And of course, the other problem, Tony Campbell, is not just parents buying them for kids. It's also delivery drivers, particularly in London, I suppose, other big cities, where it's not clear that everyone knows the rules, or at least that everyone accepts that the rules need to be followed.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, first and foremost, the sort of emergence of illegal high-powered e-bikes has significantly damaged the legitimate sector. So that's been our primary concern, sort of dating back 2 or 3 years now. In terms of the last mile delivery companies, the high proportion, and I'm up in, you know, many big cities around the UK, more often than not, I will see illegal e-bikes that are being used by the last mile delivery riders. So there needs to be more onus. So the government needs to take a closer look at what the regulation says. I know we had the issues around Uber drivers a few years ago, taxis, whether they were employed or not. But the reality is here is that I believe that the large organisations that do, you know, the food delivery, they are turning a blind eye to the fact that the services that they're employing are being delivered on illegal vehicles.
Tony Campbell and Donna Jones as well. Thank you both.
It is 17 minutes to 8 now. The movie industry has been going through a turbulent few years now, with cinema attendances in the US down by around a third on pre-COVID levels. So it's perhaps not surprising that Hollywood's been having second thoughts about some of its bigger projects. But one of the films that Warner Brothers decided to write off as a tax loss has fought back. Fans, film directors, even a US congressman have all come together to save the Wile E. Coyote movie from the scrap heap. And later this month, audiences will finally get the chance to see the Looney Tunes star taking on that American giant, the Acme Corporation. David Sellito has more.
My name is Sammy Birch. I'm the screenwriter of Coyote vs. Acme, which is
the comeback movie nobody thought we would actually get.
Wile E. Coyote, cartoon hero. Tireless, ravenous pursuer of the profoundly annoying Roadrunner, who is again and again let down by his mail-order purchases from the Acme Corporation.
Have you been horribly injured by a product made by the Acme Corporation?
He is now the star of a new movie based on a classic article about a courtroom confrontation.
Ian Fraser wrote a really famous humor piece for The New Yorker entitled Coyote v. Acme, which is a straight-faced court transcript of a trial between Wile E. Coyote and the Acme Corporation.
Have you ever set a big stack of TNT on the road hoping to blow up your nemesis, but the detonator itself explodes? Have you ever pulled the ripcord of your parachute and only a bunch of silverware comes out? It's not your fault.
Acme is evil.
And there had been, since 1990, people wanting to make this into a feature film.
And eventually, Warner Brothers gave the green light to Sammy and the rest of the team to go out and make it.
Mr. Coyote, how can I help you?
But then came the plummet to the bottom of the canyon moment. Warner's decided they'd make more money if they wrote it off against tax rather than release it.
It was a shock. I mean, it was really... I mean, the metaphors have been very literal in this case, because given what Wile E. Coyote normally experiences, where things are really going to plan and then something falls out of the sky. I mean, it really did feel like that.
And it wasn't just the cast and crew. who wanted to see it in the cinemas.
I hate to be political, but release Coyote versus Acme!
The campaign Release Coyote has gone far and wide.
It was really moving, actually, to see big directors that came out against it. There were congressmen.
Congressmen?
Yes, because that was mostly notable to me because that happens in the movie. You know, there's been a lot of parallels.
All of which ended with a company called Ketchup being allowed to take it on, which means
the Looney Tunes legal comedy that got shelved is officially back on the calendar.
Can you reassure me that this hasn't been a very clever guerrilla marketing campaign?
I can. I think the people at Ketchup Entertainment who wrote the check to buy this movie, I'm sure would make sure you would want to know that it wasn't just a joke.
And now we've seen it.
It's amazing.
I think it's the best Looney Tunes movie ever made.
Almost every time Wile E. Coyote held up a sign, it got a laugh.
And I just have to say, it lives up to the hype. And I'm still blown away that they tried to cancel this movie.
The Rotten Tomatoes collated reviews has it at a startling 95% approval.
When I saw the final movie, it was what was being called the funeral screening. And I was so proud of it. I think a lot of people thought, oh, well, it probably sucks if we're going to throw it away. And then to go, this doesn't suck.
The name of the case is Coyote versus Acme.
The fact that it's getting to come out, that kids can be introduced to these characters, it's an amazing, only happy moment.
And for Mr. Coyote, a rare moment of joy in a life of failure.
One of the most hardworking people I've ever met.
And the older you get, the more you fail in life. Surely we're all supposed to be rooting for Wile E. Coyote, aren't we? I mean,
of course. The movie takes, I think, an anti-bird stance in general.
And at the end of it, you won, haven't you?
Well, we haven't been splat yet at the bottom of the canyon, so we're taking that as a win.
David Sillitoe reporting. Just say, coming up in a few minutes, the video sharing app TikTok has agreed to pay $400 million, the equivalent of £293 million, after being accused in the United States of violating children's online privacy. We'll be talking to a former TikTok executive and to Baroness Kidron, who's campaigned on child safety in the online space in the UK. Time, though, at 11 minutes to 8 for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is the Reverend Roy Jenkins, Baptist minister in Cardiff. Roy, good morning.
Good morning, Justin. At last, a few showers. They've never been more welcome in this strange, uncomfortable, record-breaking summer. Day after day of sunshine, held fitfully at bay by air conditioning on overtime, cooling drinks and the drawn curtains which, to an earlier generation, would have signalled a community in mourning. Today, they might be reminding us of lost gardens, parched lawns and blazing hillsides, threatening some homes directly and sending a choking warning over great distances. At the same time, the heat has taken a grim toll among people seeking to cool off in rivers, lakes and at the seaside. This week, the couple and their two daughters in the sea off Shoreham, and understandably there's been huge outpouring of sympathy. The emergency response included Coast Guards, lifeboat, ambulance and police teams. And it's good to pause occasionally to honour men and women who give themselves to such services. Leading the battle against the wildfires across the country, of course, have been firefighters. We marvel at their willingness to put their own lives in jeopardy, how they must sweat before those flames, wearing their heavy protective gear, as conscious of the risk they're taking as the volunteers crewing a lifeboat in a storm, and how their families must share the anxiety. I believe the would-be rescuers reflect something of the character of a God who is also in the business of rescue, often getting people out of scrapes of their own making. It was while we were still helpless, powerless, says St. Paul, that Jesus Christ died for us. There's regular debate about how we should treat people in difficulties because of what they've consumed, knowing it could harm them. Within the rescue services, I suspect there's occasional irritation, maybe anger, at those who put themselves at risk needlessly, sailing the channel in bathtubs, attempting to scale serious peaks in flip-flops. But those who've trained for this work still do it, knowing that they might be the only hope. On a glorious sunny day 60 years ago, I ventured into the sea from a popular beach in Jersey with big waves and wonderful surf. Hardly a swimmer at all, I was soon in trouble. Currents I knew nothing of sucked me under, and no matter how I fought, I was helpless. I really thought I would drown. Before I was fished out by a team of lifesavers, feeling shaken, foolish, and very grateful, one of a dozen rescued that day. It's not how I usually put it, but I understand why some people, finding faith in Jesus, talk of being saved. Well, I've been rescued, and I'm glad today's rescue services remind me.
And that was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Roy Jenkins. It brings us to 8 minutes to eight.
Will TikTok's decision to pay nearly £300 million to settle a privacy lawsuit with the US government better protect our children online? The country's Justice Department thinks so, having brought the case saying that parent company ByteDance was illegally collecting the personal details of millions of children who used the video app. That's in contravention of a federal law brought in back in 2000 to protect young people's privacy online. And it is the same legislation, by the way, that dozens of US states are also suing Meta over in a huge court case that started this week. Both Meta and TikTok insist that they go to great lengths to protect and safeguard children's privacy. But let's take a moment to discuss what this means, what might change, if anything, as a result of it. Baroness Kidron joins us, crossbench peer, children's rights advocate in the digital world, and the author of Users, How Big Tech Took Control and How to Fight Back. And Trevor Johnson, who's a former TikTok and Meta executive who now advises tech companies. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Baroness Kidron, to you first, does this feel like a moment of change to you?
No, I think it's always a good moment when we have the headlines right across the world reminding parents that TikTok or another platform of a similar nature might not be safe. But I don't think that fines in themselves do it. I mean, you know, TikTok is worth, I think, at last count, $550 billion, and $400 million is really a drop in the ocean. In fact, I saw reporting recently that they put aside $1 billion a year for legal, you know, contestation and settling fines. And I think that we have to just hold on to the real point here is we don't want to fine them for not being safe. We want to make them safe and private in the first place.
Trevor Johnson, what difference do you think it makes in this, that this particular payment is a settlement to bring an end to a court case, which doesn't require the acceptance of wrongdoing? It's not that law actually coming to an end. It's not a conviction and a fine. Do you think that changes the outcome in any way?
Well, the background is that the Biden administration filed the suit in 2024, and it's accused TikTok of violating previous consent order, which is 2019. And as you've said, this clears that the allegations that it violated the Children's Online Privacy Act, where they pay $400 million, which is said is a small part proportion of their revenue, without undergoing further litigation or admitting wrongdoing. Now, TikTok has said that it has undergone significant changes to its ownership. We know that the part of the Trump administration, the US business has been sold, management, compliance, various functions and privacy practices. And whilst the settlement is one of the largest ever, and it's expensive, than a continued litigation with the DOJ. And the final element to this is that the question is whether or not the other element to this is whether or not a Trump-led DOJ, which has pushed the sale of TikTok to Larry Ellison and Oracle, and whether or not this was the part of the deal or part of the bailout for that. But as the Baroness has said, with the accountability of these big tech platforms for privacy and children protection has to continue to be ongoing. And yes, they'll claim that more accountability to do that is pushed. I'm not sure fines are the best way to do that. I do think that regulation is the only way that these tech platforms really push and change. And I think that these fines are a part of a tax of doing business. If you think about the likes of Google and Facebook, they pay these fines, but it's based on billions and billions and billions of pounds of business that has been done. So not a huge punishment for these sites.
We did ask at TikTok for a comment specifically on this, haven't received a response, but what they generally say in their court filings is that they have developed these sophisticated age moderation systems, that they train their personnel in underage moderation. Meta, on their case, talked about limited claims being unsubstantiated, disproportionate financial demands, the Attorney General's not offering proof that anybody in their states was misled. But I wonder, Biban, when we look at the way that the companies conduct themselves, and if we bring that back to what's happening in this country and the government, and it was the government under Keir Starmer, still the same government, but talking about actually banning under 16s from social media, do you think that's still the way forward? Can we rely on the tech companies to change things? Or do you think it needs to be a real separation of younger people from those platforms?
Listen, I think there are two things here. I mean, first of all, I absolutely agree about the pressure that has been put on various regulatory authorities, including our own and including the Starmer government from the Trump administration. I mean, since he came to power, we've seen rollback on moderation. We've seen a sort of an excess of sort of harms that have been given the idea that they are free speech instead of actual harms. And I think that this comes down to a question of sovereignty. And if I could just say, Anna, that we were the first country in the world to have very sophisticated safety regulation for children. It was called the Age Appropriate Design Code. We brought it in 2018. And it caused massive design change to the platforms until we didn't properly enforce it. And they got the idea that they had free rein. Similarly, we were right ahead of the curve with the Online Safety Act, but we have not properly enforced it. Now, some of that's down to political will.
Look, thank you both. Time is against us, but really appreciate your insight this morning, Baroness Kidron and Trevor Johnson. Thank you.
It is a minute before 8 o'clock. Let's go to the weather. Sarah Keith Lucas has it this morning. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Justin. Good morning. A mostly dry weekend ahead for most of us. We have had some useful rainfall over the next few days, but a bit of a pause in showers at the moment. Just a few isolated showers today, and they'll be found around the east coast of England, particularly for the likes of East Yorkshire, Lincolnshire, into Norfolk as well, one or two across the north of Wales, and a few across the northwest of Scotland too. But elsewhere, largely dry, sunny spells, a little bit more cloud generally across Scotland and Northern Ireland. For England and Wales, long spells of sunshine this morning, but a bit more cloud will bubble up into the afternoon. Top temperatures today a little warmer than recent days, 16 to 18 in the north, 19 to 23 in the south. It'll be a fairly fresh but dry night tonight, and tomorrow looks dry and a touch warmer than today.
Thank you, Sarah. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
It's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 22nd of August. The headlines this morning: TikTok has agreed to pay $400 million in the United States in what's been described as one of the largest child privacy settlements in history. The Economist Lord O'Neill says he will not be taking a job in government, despite being widely expected to work under Andy Burnham. And the Duchess of Sussex is in talks to return to acting with a role in the Guy Ritchie Netflix series The Gentleman.
Still to come on the programme this morning, Ukrainian strikes on Russia are squeezing petrol supplies.
I'm outside a petrol station. I have to say, I've never seen queues for petrol in the Russian capital as long as this. The road leading up to the petrol station is absolutely packed with cars. I've counted about 60 and they keep coming.
As ordinary Russians feel the pinch at the pumps, our attitudes towards Vladimir Putin starting to change. And as Anthony Hopkins releases his first album at 88, we'll be talking about the benefits of taking up new hobbies much later in life.
And good morning from Mike Williams with your Saturday Sport. The brand new Premier League season begins with a comfortable 3-0 win for the champions Arsenal over Coventry City. Elsewhere in tennis, Jannik Sinner and Jack Draper both pull out of next week's US Open. And coming up, we will look back on an emphatic victory for England's cricketers over Pakistan inside 3 days at Headingley.
The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The video sharing app TikTok has agreed to pay $400 million, the equivalent of £293 million, after being accused in the United States of violating children's online privacy. The US Justice Department called the settlement a major victory for parents and their children, saying they were safer now than when the case began. Our North America technology correspondent Lily Jamali reports.
This agreement is being called one of the largest child privacy settlements in history. The lawsuit was brought by the U.S. Department of Justice in 2024 when Joe Biden was president. The department alleged TikTok and its parent company ByteDance collected vast amounts of data on millions of users under the age of 13, including names and email addresses. TikTok had been accused of violating the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, a federal law known as COPPA. That same law is the one several U.S. states allege that Meta has violated, which it denies. That case is currently being heard by a court in California. YouTube and the Fortnite maker Epic Games have also reached settlements over alleged breaches of COPPA. A representative for TikTok contacted for comment by the BBC did not respond.
The economist Lord O'Neill says he will not be taking a job in Andy Burnham's government. He'd been advising the Prime Minister and had previously served as a Treasury Minister under the Conservatives. More details from our political correspondent David Cornock.
Jim O'Neill, a former chief economist at Goldman Sachs, had been tipped to become the Prime Minister's chief economic advisor. But as first reported by the Financial Times, he's decided not to take a government job. He said he was enjoying what he's currently doing too much and didn't want to have to give up control of his business interests to comply with official rules. The crossbench peer stressed his decision was not due to policy disagreements, and he was a massive fan of Andy Burnham's focus on devolution. He said he hoped the Prime Minister and his team would be bold and to maintain an informal relationship with them.
The United States has imposed 50% tariffs on some Canadian goods after last-ditch trade talks between the two countries failed to reach an agreement. The duties cover 5.5% of total exports to the US from Canada and include products from cement to hockey sticks. The Canadian Prime Minister, Mark Carney, pledged to match the tariffs dollar for dollar. The BBC has been told the Duchess of Sussex is in talks to appear in a TV series being made by Netflix. There's been speculation that a return to her former acting career is one of the reasons Meghan and Prince Harry are moving back to the UK with their young children. Here's our senior royal correspondent, Daniela Ralph.
The BBC has learnt that the Duchess of Sussex is in talks to appear in the Netflix series The Gentleman, created by the British film director Guy Ritchie. Discussions are in their early stages, but this would be the first significant acting role for Meghan since her marriage to Prince Harry. The Gentleman is a comedy series about a duke who becomes a drug baron. Much of the two previous series of the show have been filmed in the Cotswolds, close to where it's rumoured Harry and Meghan will set up home in the UK. Although the details of a possible role for Meghan have not been revealed, it's becoming increasingly clear that her return to acting has been an important part of the family decision to come back to the UK.
A 6-year-old girl who was rescued from the water off the coast of West Sussex on Tuesday has died in hospital. Saja Al-Khawas's mother, father and older sister Sarah all died during the incident in Shoreham. Here's our UK correspondent, Daniel Sanford.
It was on Tuesday afternoon that four members of the British-Palestinian family from London got into difficulty in the water near the Old Fort. There was a huge emergency response involving a lifeboat, the Coast Guard, ambulances, police and helicopters. Despite the rescue efforts, Hassan Al-Khawas, his wife Zaina Alain and their 14-year-old daughter Sarah all died. Her younger sister, 6-year-old Saja, survived and was taken to hospital in a critical condition. But Sussex police have confirmed that she has now also died. The force said that after looking at CCTV footage and talking to eyewitnesses, they currently think the deaths were a tragic accident.
Ukraine says at least two people have been killed in the latest Russian strikes on the capital, Kyiv, and the southern city of Zaporizhia. The number of dead after drones hit a shopping centre in Kryvyi Rih yesterday has risen to 16. The NHS in England says hot temperatures this summer have led to a surge in the number of people reporting insect bites and stings. Figures suggest there were more than 1,200 hospital visits in May, more than double the previous month. There was also a 35% rise in hits on the NHS website for advice on bites and stings between June and July. Patients are being urged to use pharmacies to get treatments. Thoran Govind is a pharmacist.
With the heat waves that we have been experiencing, I see this as an area where we're going to get busier in healthcare. And that's why it's really important that we support patients to self-care in their own homes, but also to know when things are more serious. And it's important to seek pharmacist advice, GP advice, or 999, and it's a hospital situation.
The A31, a dual carriageway that runs through the New Forest, has reopened after being closed for almost a fortnight because of wildfires that spread to the national park. The incident started when a van caught fire. The first vehicles are thought to have been allowed back onto the A31 early this morning. China's second World Humanoid Robot Games will officially open in Beijing this weekend. The event will feature more than 2,000 robots from 16 different countries. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports.
There are 666 teams competing this week, and although competitors have come from Japan, Germany and the United States, 641 teams are from China. President Xi has made developing robots and the artificial intelligence needed to program them a strategic priority in a growing technological race with the US. China's robot makers have spent the last 2 years showing their machines can dance, run marathons and play football. But this year, 38 teams will also be judged on domestic work, including folding laundry. Because for future investors, that's now the difference between a technological spectacle and a commercially viable future.
The FBI has returned 48 looted antiquities to Egypt after an investigation into an alleged trafficking operation. The objects, spanning thousands of years of Egyptian history, were handed over at a ceremony in Los Angeles, from where our North America correspondent Shaima Khalil reports.
Carved figures, amulets and objects once placed inside ancient tombs are among the artifacts which have been handed back to Egypt. The 48 pieces date from the Pharaonic, Roman and Coptic periods. The FBI in Los Angeles says experts confirmed they'd been illegally removed from the country, but the investigation remains open as agents search for possible accomplices and other missing treasures. The operation is part of an agreement signed by Washington and Cairo in 2016, designed to stop trafficked antiquities entering America and help send stolen objects home. The FBI says trafficking antiquities isn't simply the theft of a country's history. It can also help fund international criminal and terrorist organizations.
A Japanese father has been reprimanded by police after leaving his 7-year-old son alone on Mount Fuji during a family hike. The child had reportedly complained of feeling tired at 6,500 feet, but his father and an older sibling opted to continue onwards towards the summit. The boy was told to wait where he was before being found alone in rain and fog by a passerby. The Premier League champions Arsenal have kicked off the top flight season with a 3-0 victory against newly promoted Coventry. The goals last night were scored by Kai Havertz, Bukayo Saka and Martin Odegaard. Speaking afterwards, the Arsenal manager Mikel Arteta was asked if his players were now more relaxed, having won their first title together.
They look exactly the same to me. Inside of each player, I don't know what's going on. What I did transmit is more desire and more will to improve, to be better and to earn the right to be better than anybody else, and that's what we want to do.
That was the Arsenal manager, Mikel Arteta.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. There has been a flurry of economic news this week. Some of it, like government borrowing, not particularly good. What are we to make of that news? And the fact that Jim O'Neill, Lord O'Neill, is not joining the government. Lord O'Neill had a long career in the world of finance. He was briefly a Conservative Treasury Minister. He is now a crossbench independent peer. He's been a supporter of Andy Burnham when it comes to getting power out of London and into Manchester and other centres. But he's also seen as someone who is attuned to the need to be financially realistic. In other words, to work within the constraints that are imposed by reality when it comes to how wealthy we actually are as a nation and what the various decisions to be made in the budget will do to that wealth, increase it over time or decrease it. Andy Burnham already facing, of course, a tricky political set of decisions on asylum seekers, on prison releases as well. But it is fair to say that the budget, when it comes at the end of October, is going to be the event that defines really what his government is all about. And Lord O'Neill, Jim O'Neill, joins us on the line now. Morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
Have you fallen out with Andy Burnham?
No, I haven't. But I had a very nice note from Andy overnight. So not in this. The only big difference we have is that he's an Everton fan and I'm a Man United fan.
Right, which is quite a big one, I suppose. But let's put that to one side. The reason then that you're not going to do the job that a lot thought you were going to do, the formal job for him?
When it came to it, Justin, it's just I've got lots of other things that are going on that I very much enjoy. And having been a minister before and having to have all the constraints that understandably go with it, like a blind trust and sort of abandon everything else you do, never mind the fact that it's 24/7, I came to the conclusion I'd rather just be a voice if they want to talk to me, that is, occasionally. And get on with the rest of the things in my life.
Right, and you are expecting, are you, to be a voice? You are hoping and indeed are willing to be an advisor behind the scenes?
Well, particularly on what seems to be, and I think, is the prime new development under Andy's leadership is the whole focus on devolution and stronger regional growth. Obviously, since I left my life at Goldman 13 years ago, I've been deeply involved in all of that, especially as it relates to the North. So it might well be that they have plenty of other more useful voices to listen to than mine. But obviously, it's something I'm very passionate about. And one of the roles I do, which is chairing Northern Gritstone, which invests in startups coming out of Northern universities, I'm deeply involved in. So I'm in this space, irrelevant of whether I'm a formal or not formal voice.
We'll get to some of the headwinds that the government's facing at the moment, the economic headwinds. But just before we do that, on the positive side of the ledger, as it were, what can you see that potentially gives this government the space to do things that it needs?
Well, I think looking at the anecdotal data, and maybe we'll come on to it more, whether it's coincidence or because of Andy's tone in coming into office, that the most recent high-frequency data is actually rather more encouraging than it's been for quite a long time in the UK. And I think the important thing from the economic cycle perspective, it comes in when there's a very high savings rate by the UK's rather low standards, and it reflects that everybody's had all these concerns for so long. And if people can start to feel a bit more upbeat about things, there's a decent chance that savings rate comes down and people start to consume and spend more. And then on the specific policies, as Andy has come to this job from in Greater Manchester has shown that if you have bold ambition and genuine accountability with your local elected leaders, things can change. And Greater Manchester, as has been discussed endlessly now the past few weeks, has grown three times the rate of London for the past 15 years and has been the biggest growing urban conurbation in the country. And if you can repeat that around a number of places with a lot of people, then if you just simply add up the mass, then the national economic performance would improve.
And does that give the space then for the kind of changes, the kind of reforms, the kind of cuts, actually, to use a blunter word, in welfare spending, in other areas of spending that some say needs to be part of this package?
I mean, as I've talked about to you guys a number of times on the programme, I'm also a supporter of a lot more sensible approach to government spending and taxation. And I think, as Andy himself has emphasised, and if you listen to the words he says carefully, genuine welfare reform. And I think one of the things that's been driving Andy's thinking and his team, led by Caroline Simpson at number 10 North, is something they were doing in Manchester called a prevention demonstrator, where they're trying to integrate things from many different departments that are all necessary to help those that are left behind, whether it's NEETs or people with mental health issues, the issues surrounding broader health matters, young people's education, homelessness, and so on. And one of the things I suspect that we'll get progress on in terms of devolution is a more integrated approach that cuts across the traditional siloed departmental approach to these things. And I'm a strong believer that you're only going to be able to really solve those issues and cut the welfare bill if you have a more joined up approach. And I think that's going to feature amongst what this government's going to do.
The figures for borrowing, I was saying that, well, you were outlining what the positive things were, but the figures for borrowing for July weren't good, were they? Because there should normally be a surplus for the government in July because of various anomalies in the system, but actually there wasn't. Will there need to be tax rises in the budget, do you think?
I mean, obviously that's going to be a choice for the Prime Minister, his Chancellor and team, based on the things they're saying they want to do more of. Defence spending is obviously the one that catches the eye, but also a number of other things. But I would hope that there's the same kind of strength of focus that Andy's showing on devolution to dealing with what I occasionally call the sacred cows, but these days I try to call them the golden opportunities. You know, the UK has 10-year bond yields considerably higher than many other countries these days, including somewhere like Greece. And they're not there just by coincidence. It's because of the huge rise in spending we've had in the past 15 years or so. And a lot of leaders and advisors seem to be scared by the politics of dealing with any of these things. But I think there's a huge reward for a leader that's prepared to take these things on.
But I suppose what some Labour backbenchers would say to that, well, one way of calming the bond markets will be to say, look, we are going to raise in taxes the extra that we want to spend. And I suppose the question to you is whether that is an option, for instance, with wealth taxes or whatever else they might come up with.
Well, as you said in the intro and the FT piece yesterday covered, and because I've said it the past few weeks, I'm not a fan of further increases in these kind of taxes, particularly as it relates to capital gains for genuine risk-taking things like venture capital. You know, we need more genuine risk-taking and more entrepreneurs, and we need to boot these sort of green shoots of growth that are there, which some of which do appear to have emerged from the previous government, actually. But we need to boost those more. And the last thing we should be doing is trying to discourage genuine risk-taking. So, again, at the end of the day, that's a choice for the government, but I would not be in favour of that at all.
What about the banks? Because that, again, to a lot of Labour backbenchers, it seems pretty easy money in a way. The banks have made huge profits recently. Why not just take a larger share of that?
I mean, all of these things are just be temporary measures. I think the underlying dynamics behind why our deficit issue is the way that it is and the debt levels have risen so much is we've just boosted government spending dramatically in recent years. And I think as many people talk about, and I'm amongst them, sooner or later, if the country wants to have a sustained better longer-term growth performance, we've got to deal with those things. I'd include the triple lock as well as a more realistic approach to a more sensible approach to welfare spending under genuine welfare reform. And I think we are going to see the latter from Andy, and the Milburn review is pretty important in that regard, I would say.
Lord O'Neill, Jim O'Neill, thank you very much for talking to us.
It's coming round to 20 past eight. It's only a week or so now until the Duke and Duchess of Sussex leave the US to relocate to the UK. The breaking of that news a few days ago has led to significant questions about things like the family's privacy and their security. But there are also broader concerns in some quarters. We don't know a great deal about Harry and Meghan's motivation or their intent, which has left open the possibility that they might be planning some type of return to official life or perhaps to become a rival court to his brother William and Catherine. The fractured relationship between the brothers inevitably is what has led to that particular line of speculation. Roy Anikar joins us, the Sunday Times' royal editor, and Baroness Wheatcroft, who's a former editor of the Sunday Telegraph. Good morning, both.
Morning.
Good morning, Anna.
Roya, I think, well, first of all, do you think there's any possibility at all that that is on the cards? Or is that just the inevitable product of the huge amount of speculation that surrounds Harry and Meghan?
I think there are so many unknowns about this return to the UK. Of course, we've had the news, recent news overnight, that Meghan is returning to acting. You know, it's not clear how much Harry will try and scale up his work with his charities and patronage here. But, you know, the very fact that they are returning here in a matter of days, the fact that they'll be living here, their children are at school here, we know that Harry will want to see the King much more. You are going to have a rival court here. And, you know, it's one thing to have an alternative royal court out in California, but it's going to be a real challenge for all the players involved to see how that evolves and unfolds here. And I think there will be tensions and there will be bumps and it'll be difficult. Reconciliation, you know, possibly more so with the King. I think that will continue to evolve. We know the King's delighted to see him more in private. I think the move back to the UK will make things even trickier between the brothers, I suspect.
Yeah, I suppose, Roy, there are lots of practical challenges, aren't there? For example, official royal events. If you turn up, then you're trying to steal the spotlight. If you don't, then you're giving the cold shoulder. If Meghan goes back to acting, which is very much the suggestion, what happens when she has to publicise that particular thing and she's sitting in a chair with a succession of journalists who'll be asking her not just about the latest project, but about what's gone on with the royals as well? Lots of things to navigate.
There are. I mean, I don't think that will be an issue for Meghan, because Meghan's shown, you know, she's pretty capable of answering questions about the royal family when she's promoting things. I don't think they're going to turn up to royal events uninvited. And the King has been incredibly clear. People close to the King have been incredibly clear that there will be no return to official royal life. But that said, the very fact they're going to be here, they are going to be going out and, you know, particularly Harry will be going out and doing events to support his charities like Invictus. We've got the Invictus Games here next year and his other charities. He'll want to do more of that. He will want to scale it up. And so it will look like, you know, the way Harry does his engagements is very royal. There are crowds, there's security. You know, he's very well received. He does it very well. They are going to look like royal engagements. So regardless of whether or not the King says there is no return to official working royal life, you are going to have Harry and Meghan effectively as working royals working in their own way back in the UK. And that will probably blur some lines with the public.
Mm. And so, Baroness Wheatcroft, how to deal with that? What do you think that Harry and Meghan should do, should consider, should take into account when they get back and when they start making those plans?
I think the onus is very much on them to make it work. They took the decision to leave. They've taken the decision to return. And if they want to make this a viable choice, they have to really shut up for a bit. Just concentrate on doing what they're supposed to do, not grabbing headlines. Now, that won't be easy. We saw as soon as the news came out that they were coming back, that the front pages and 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of the tabloids were covered with stories about these two, who have a very enticing story to tell as far as many of the public are concerned. But they just need to keep a very low profile and do their best to support the person who is carrying the load at the moment, the King, and the person who has got the role of taking over from him eventually, Prince William. And despite the tensions between the brothers, I think the only way of those being healed really is for Harry to be the one who makes the effort to be supportive, to be low profile, apart from in the things where he really has a role, and that's outside royal duties. Because as the late Queen said very clearly, you can't be half in and half out. You're either a working royal or you're not. They've opted to be not working royals. And therefore, yes, they have to have a career.
Yes, that was going to be my question. Do you think that will work, as you suggest? Because ultimately, they need to make money too. And those two things of being quiet but bringing the money in aren't always compatible.
Well, it should be compatible. It won't be easy. the first thing any actress wants is publicity. And Meghan, maybe, I'm not qualified to judge, she may be a good actress, she's certainly going to be offered roles, but she has to be very careful when the inevitable interviews come along not to embarrass her family, the royal family. And I think that that will be tricky, but it should be possible. And the media will try inevitably to prize stories out of them, because certainly with much of the media, these two are not popular. I mean, Harry's war against newspapers and the media generally has been not just costly, but it's really created a lot of enemies. And so he's going to have to be extremely careful. Mm. But I think he will have enough money to survive.
Yeah, there's a lot of things in the mix, as you both rightly identify there. Thank you for joining us this morning, Baroness Wheatcroft and Roy Anika.
26 minutes past eight. Coming up after the news bulletin, as ordinary Russians feel pressure at the pumps from the war in Ukraine. Is the dial shifting on attitudes to Vladimir Putin? Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, has a special report after the news.
Well, before that, Mike's back.
Hello, Anna. Yes, tough start to life back in the Premier League for newly promoted Coventry City last night. They were beaten 3-0 in their first top flight match for 25 years by the defending champions, Arsenal. So the champions off and running for the new campaign. Later today, the opening weekend continues with Hull City, another newly promoted side, against Manchester United in the early kickoff. You can then hear Nottingham Forest against Leeds on 5 Live from 3 p.m. That is followed by Brentford Tottenham at 5:30. We now, though, are going to talk about a comprehensive victory for England's cricketers at Headingley.
Archer into Bolton. Mohammed Abbas, who gives himself some room and clubs this high in the air. He's going to be caught. A backward point he is. It's all over. Pakistan out for 135 in their second innings. England win by an innings and plenty, and Pakistan outplayed from the first ball to the last ball. An emphatic victory for Joe Root and his team.
Yes, England stormed to victory in the first test against Pakistan yesterday at Headingley. Inside 3 days, England eventually winning by an innings and 103 runs. Well, let's chat to the former England bowler, Stephen Finn, who joins us live on the programme. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
That really was, wasn't it, a near faultless performance from England?
Yes, and it's just nice to have some good news around this England team after what happened in the winter with the Ashes and how it all transpired during that New Zealand series that ended up in Ben Stokes retiring and Brendan McCullum losing his job as the head coach. Yeah, it was nice to be able to sit behind the bowler's arm and watch an England victory this week.
Fair to say, is it that this is though not a great Pakistan side that we're seeing over here?
No, it was a real shame, actually, that you usually think of Pakistan coming and they've got really exciting fast bowlers or mystery spinners or these prolific batters who can make you field for days and days. But yeah, it was a disappointing performance from them. Clearly, tricky conditions, very different to what they're used to at home. But yeah, it was a shame it wasn't more of a contest. But I don't think Joe Root's complaining in his first day or game back in the job as full-time captain.
Well, I was going to say, it's exactly the start that Root will have dreamt of, isn't it? An emphatic victory in his first match back as captain at his home ground. I mean, this really does kickstart his second spell as skipper, doesn't it? How long do you expect him to be England captain for? Do you think this is a short-term, medium-term or long-term solution?
I would say medium-term, because I think that there are some really big series coming up. Clearly, this one is big for the team in the sense that they need to get everything back on track from where it has been. So winning this is a non-negotiable, and they made a really good start this week. But then you look at the next 18 months that are coming up, and there's an away series in South Africa against the World Test champions. Then you've got a tour to Bangladesh, which is going to be very tricky in their conditions. A home Ashes series followed by an away India series. And I would look at that 18-month period as maybe the end of Root's captaincy, but and a natural progression onto whoever comes next. But I think if he goes well, and if he enjoys it, and if the team are successful, there's no reason it can't go on beyond that. So I would say he's been bought in to steady the ship, and it looked a lot steadier this week.
Just finally, on that Ashes series next summer, Steve, briefly, I want to ask you about some comments from Root that are being reported by the BBC and elsewhere that he made after the victory yesterday, where he said it would have been nice for the players to have had some say, some input over which grounds host those home Ashes test matches next summer. Of course, famously, no Northern Grounds, no Headingley, no Old Trafford across that Ashes series next summer. Is Root right? Should the players be consulted?
I would say that in massive series like the Ashes, where people's captaincy tenures are defined by those series, coaches are judged on how they perform in the Ashes and how they perform against India. As a player, and I'm looking from a player's perspective here, not an administrator, I would want to play at the five grounds that gave us the best chance of winning those test matches and creating a legacy for the team, and bringing happiness and success to the people who are watching. So yeah, I would agree that some degree of consultation and looking at the stats of where England perform best would be a good way to determine where those series are played. But I think there's also an understanding from an administrative level, it's important that it's not always the same grounds. But yeah, in his reference specifically to Headingley, it's a shame not to see an Ashes test there because of how many iconic moments we've had at that ground in that series.
Yeah, 7 wins in a row for England at Headingley. Great to have you on the programme this morning. Many thanks to the former England bowler Stephen Finn for his thoughts there. The second test between England and Pakistan starts at Lord's on Thursday. And just to leave you with a bit of tennis news, world number one Jannik Sinner and Britain's Jack Draper have both pulled out of the US Open, which starts next week at Flushing Meadows. Draper really has had a rotten 2026. He's now missed all four Grand Slams with injury and has slipped to 43 in the world rankings.
Right, thank you. Here's what is coming up this morning on Radio 4.
Soul music.
There's huge tenderness in it.
The series exploring the powerful emotional impact of music.
While it represents loss for me, I've been able to see so much beauty.
I took my love, took it down.
Featuring Fleetwood Mac and a global disco hit.
Music became frozen in time. People held on to the music instead of fading away.
Will a landslide bring you
soul music. The new series continues on Saturday mornings at 10:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say play Radio 4.
It is 27 minutes to 9. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
The video sharing app TikTok has agreed to pay the equivalent of nearly £300 million after being accused in the United States of violating children's online privacy. The US Justice Department called the settlement a major victory for parents and their children. TikTok did not immediately comment. The economist Lord O'Neill says he will not be taking a job in Andy Burnham's government. He'd been advising the Prime Minister and previously served as Treasury Minister under the Conservatives. Jim O'Neill told this programme he had not fallen out with Mr Burnham, but does not want to abandon his other commitments. The United States has imposed 50% tariffs on some Canadian goods after last-ditch trade talks between the two countries failed to reach an agreement. The duties cover 5.5% of total exports to the US from Canada. And BBC News has been told the Duchess of Sussex is in talks to appear in the Netflix series The Gentleman. There's been speculation that a return to her former acting career is one of the reasons Meghan and Prince Harry are moving back to the UK with their young children.
Thank you, Alan. TikTok is paying nearly £300 million to settle a lawsuit with the US government, which was suing it over claims it violated children's privacy by collecting their personal details. Storing things like names and email addresses violates a more than 25-year-old federal law that was designed to protect young people's privacy online. And it's worth saying that is the same legislation that dozens of US states are also suing Meta over in a major court case that started this week. The tech companies say that they are already going to great lengths to safeguard children online. But what does this moment mean for them and for us as well? Zoe Kleiman is the BBC's technology editor, joins me now. Hello, Zoe.
Good morning.
What is fascinating here, I think, is something that Baroness Kidron said a little bit earlier, that this law is from, this federal law in the US is from 2000. She said the laws have been here in this country for quite a long time now. It's not necessarily a case of the laws not existing. It's more a case of them not always being enforced the way they should be.
Yeah, I think, you know, if we briefly go back in a time machine to 1998, which was when this US law was passed, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, it's also called COPPA, we didn't have any social media. We didn't have any kind of tech in the way that we have now. We're in a totally different era in 2026. And yet here we are with a piece of legislation that's nearly 30 years old, and it's doing a lot of heavy lifting. You know, at the heart of this TikTok settlement is technically, as you said, children's online privacy and the collection of their data. It's not about online harm. It's not about misinformation. It's not about all of the vast sprawling topics that the Online Safety Act here in the UK has to cover. It's very straightforward. You need parental consent to collect children's data if they're under the age of 13 in the US. And the US administration back in 2024 said that TikTok wasn't doing that. And TikTok has now decided to settle that case, even though not only are we in a very different space right now, but TikTok itself has changed, because it used to be the whole platform was owned by a company called ByteDance, and then the US wanted to ban it because of ByteDance's connections with China. It's still headquartered in Beijing, and now there's a whole new company that's been set up to run TikTok's US platform. So it's not even the same product anymore, but this little bit of 30-year-old legislation is still doing a lot of groundwork, and it's also at the heart of the massive Meta trial that's going on, you know, where we've got 29 states accusing it of misusing children's data, which, by the way, Meta denies. But underpinning that is this little act as well. I think it's really interesting, isn't it, that we feel worried that legislation can't keep up with the pace of technology. But here's an example that actually perhaps it can.
Yeah, and we're bracketing the week with these two big tech stories, which could have a huge implication for all of us. Thank you, Zoe, for your insight. As always, Zoe Kleiman there, the BBC's technology editor.
23 minutes to nine. Talking of tech, are you looking forward to the robot games? They begin in Beijing today, competing in traditional sports, but also in bricklaying, in bottle cap opening. Elon Musk, in an interview with The Economist last month, said he loved these games.
Well, and then they have the sort of like a boxing match or a fighting match with the robots, which is quite entertaining. And I saw some video of a robot that got his head knocked off, kept fighting, even with its head knocked off. It looked pretty funny. But, I mean, in fact, I think the robot battles are going to be quite entertaining to watch.
He's also said, of course, in other interviews, that the robots might take over and kill us all. So that's another way of looking at it. Let's talk to Gavin Cooney, who's a sports correspondent. The Irish Times has been writing about the humanoid Olympics. Morning to you.
Morning.
What do you make of what's going on in Beijing?
I find it obviously very creepy and weird, and part of my general terror and anxiety around the future that awaits us all. I'm sure you've seen some of the viral clips, like Musk even referred to one there about, you know, a robot's head falls off and they keep fighting. I mean, the clips that go viral from these games, it'll happen this year, it happened at last year's inaugural games, are the ones in which things go wrong. You know, there was a humanoid robot that ran the 1500 meters last year, and it was a DNF because his head flew off. You know, the football match looked like a scene out of Father Ted's old priest over 75's five-a-side. You know, it's just that slow moving, and the robots kept tripping over each other. So I quite like watching the robots malfunction, because it puts me somewhat at ease about our terrifying future. Maybe these robots aren't all they're cracked up to be. But realistically, I mean, who really wants to watch an Olympics in the future in which robots replace humans? Because it is the human limits that makes things interesting, right? I mean, as I can't believe I'm already talking like this. As a fellow human, I understand the limits the athletes have, and they must transcend, and that gives us the context, which is much more interesting than robots.
But when you say that the clips that people like are the ones where they go wrong, and obviously they are, isn't that because we are kidding ourselves that we are going to remain in this position with us able to do things and the robots not into the long-term future? And these games are designed to warn us that we're not.
Exactly. I do agree. While there's 51 events at these games, and 30 of them are the traditional sports, some of which I've described there, there are 21 other scenario-based events, such as you mentioned, housekeeping, book sorting, and such things. And they're designed as showcases to show what the robots can do and ultimately replace human jobs. So while we can distract ourselves, exactly as you say, by athletic robots' heads flying off, in the background, there is also robots being trained and being judged on their ability to do human work, which makes me think that the terrifying vision of the future is not one in which we're watching robots for sport, but one in which the robots are watching us.
Yeah. And the other slightly terrifying thing is, I can't remember what the percentage is, but it's a very high percentage, isn't it, of the robots taking part are Chinese. In other words, and of course the whole thing is happening in Beijing, in other words, not just that robots are going to take over, but also that the Chinese are way ahead in this technology.
Yeah, I mean, the entire games are effectively an expo for robotics technology. And it's, you know, it's natural that it's being held in China and in Beijing, which very much wants to, you know, the country that wants to place itself at the vanguard of our coming robotic and AI age. Obviously, you know, the Magnificent Seven of the big tech companies are in the United States. But, you know, this forward thinking robotics technology, evidently China wants to flex itself as the global home of that. You know, while they host these robotics games, declining superpower of the United States distracts themselves by preparing to host the lame and stale Human Olympic Games in Los Angeles in 2028.
Gavin Cooney from the Irish Times. Thank you.
19 minutes to nine. In Russia, it is Flag Day. There'll be a string of patriotic events aimed at rallying Russian national support at what is a difficult time for the country. The Russian public's feeling the effects of the war more than ever. And Ukrainian drone strikes on oil refineries have now triggered a widespread fuel shortage. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg has been gauging the mood in Moscow.
I'm outside a petrol station. I have to say I've never seen queues for petrol in the Russian capital as long as this. The road leading up to the petrol station is absolutely packed with cars. I've counted about 60 and they keep coming. And there's another road to my right leading up to the petrol pumps and it too is packed with vehicles. But at least the sign here is saying that there is petrol right now in this place. Many of the petrol stations in Moscow right now are empty. I head to another petrol station nearby. There's another long queue of cars, although the signboard on the forecourt indicates they're out of fuel here. The drivers are waiting, though, hoping that petrol will appear. They say that there will be more fuel. One of the drivers, Sviatoslav, says optimistically, maybe today or perhaps tomorrow. The cause of the current petrol shortages across Russia are the Ukrainian drone strikes on Russian oil refineries. These, in turn, are a response to Russia's continued attacks on Ukraine. For months now, Ukrainian strikes have been cutting refining capacity and squeezing supply. Now they're making life very uncomfortable for Russian drivers. What does the Russian government say about that? A few days ago, when a pro-Kremlin reporter asked Russia's energy minister, when will petrol be back at the pumps? He replied, no comment. Do you have problems filling up? Asked the journalist. I use diesel, he replied. There's plenty of that. It's not just attacks on oil facilities that are bringing the war back home to Russians. Ukraine has also been targeting depots and warehouses, and some of the drone strikes have caused civilian casualties. Yet this week, President Putin insisted there are no critical consequences from such attacks. There have not been, and there cannot be.
Maybe he is trying to hypnotize himself, that everything is okay. It looks like he believes in his own words.
Andrei Kolesnikov is a columnist for the independent news outlet Novaya Gazeta. He claims that something is happening now in Russia that never used to. Increasingly, Russians are blaming the man at the top.
Putin was untouchable. Now it is not so. He also shares responsibility for what is happening with the economy, with the social life, with everything around us. Not for everyone, for a big bunch of people, he's still a symbol of victorious, glorious war. But, let's say, average Russian doesn't accept the idea that Putin is untouchable right now. He's also responsible for all that stuff. Where is the end of this war? Why we are so unsuccessful? Why we have this petrol crisis? Why we are somewhere nearby where economic crisis is? A lot of questions without answers.
Just round the corner from the petrol stations I've been to, I discover another queue. This time, not for petrol, but for candy floss. It's a patriotic street party for Russian Flag Day. My country, my fate, my dream, he sings. I'm raising my flag, the flag of my country. Red, blue and white Russian tricolours are being handed out to passers-by. In Russia, they may be low on petrol, but there is a never-ending supply of patriotism here. Amid all the problems, the authorities want Russians to rally round the flag. We live in a wonderful country, she says, and Russia will always be victorious. They've set up a stall in the corner with military hardware, from Kalashnikovs to handheld rocket launchers. And it's a case of come on down. Everyone's welcome to pick up and pose with the weapons. There are children here doing just that. But guns and patriotic fervour don't make difficulties disappear. Our problems, one woman here tells me, are high prices, petrol shortages, and last night, for the first time, my windows shook. I heard boom, boom. Right now, she says, it's important to take care of your psychological state so that it's unbreakable, so that whatever happens, you can say, oh well, never mind. Most Russians seem to have come to the conclusion that there is nothing they can do to change what is happening around them. All they can do is wait and hope that somehow, at some point, their problems fade away.
That was our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg. It brings us to 13 minutes to nine. Press freedom and press regulation is back on the agenda here. On both the left and the right of our politics, there are complaints about journalists. Sky News is being investigated for allegedly harassing Nigel Farage's daughter, Zach Polansky. The Green leader says the press should be sorted out in the wake of the inquiries into Jason Arday, the Cambridge professor, which Mr. Polansky thinks were motivated at least in part by racism. And now Prince Harry, of course, is back in the country, well, nearly, and the prince himself having to pay a huge sum in legal costs after an action against the Daily Mail, which the paper says was an attempt to destroy a newspaper and the reputations of its journalists. Let us talk to Fraser Nelson, columnist for The Times, former editor, of course, of The Spectator, and Sir Alan Moses as well, former Lord Chief Justice of Lord Justice of Appeal, a Court of Appeal judge, and former chairman of the Independent Press Standards Organisation, IPSO. Morning to you both.
Morning.
Morning.
Just a brief thought before we talk about wider issues about the Harry case. Sir Alan, do you think he has been harshly treated by the judge in this case?
Well, you'd have to be at court and you'd have to read the judgment, but the judge took a very dim view as to the conduct of the claimants in pursuing what he regarded as an unreasonable case. And it's very important that there are rules that claimants who behave like that then are punished with an order for indemnity costs. In other words, much harsher order as to costs than would otherwise be given.
He has said that it was a complete and obvious whitewash, he, Harry, about the case.
Disappointed litigants are rather apt to go public about the quality of the justice they receive. Mm.
Fraser Nelson, what do you make of the upshot of it and what happens now?
Well, this was the result of Harry trying to bring a case against newspapers with no evidence. That's what the judge was saying. It was the whole hacking claims were a dripping roast that had been going on for quite some time, where people didn't think they needed to bring evidence, and the judge finally called an end to this. So hopefully this will end a chapter of litigation which has been going on for far too long.
Right. So turning to wider issues, Fraser, first of all, a public inquiry is what some are calling for now. Vaguely, a public inquiry, possibly Leveson 2, this inquiry that Sir Brian Leveson had into the press some years ago. What do you make of what the press faces now, legitimately and illegitimately?
Well, it's quite interesting because the same voices who've always wanted governments to control the regulate the press somehow, they always pick up a new kind of excuse to do it. And we can see this never has quite gone away. It tends not to go anywhere, though, because ultimately the free press is one of the bedrocks of British society and democracy. And that's usually something people conclude is worth keeping after they consider the alternatives. But of course, there's going to be, you know, campaigners, anti-press campaigners. You've got the hacked off campaign, which is still quite high up in the Liberal Democrats. So we'll see. I mean, it doesn't surprise me, but the media picture is changing so much. If you look at the top 10 news sources now, you won't see a newspaper in those top 10. The BBC remains the number one in the spoken and the written word. And social media is filling in the rest of the gaps. So the media landscape is changing far faster than this debate.
Given that media landscape and given the other arguments that are swirling around, Sir Alan, do you think it would be useful to have any kind of inquiry now, further inquiry into the press?
Can you imagine yet another inquiry? What an awful, dismal prospect. No, it'd be a very bad idea. The trouble is that people can't make up their mind what they want from the press. I mean, during August, the sight of the pack of the press pursuing a particular victim, Dr. Arde, was incredibly dispiriting. But to reject that isn't to say that you need more regulation. What we really need are more newspapers and more people reading them. That's the real remedy. And the really depressing thing is the triumph of uncurated, unedited news stories on the social media, rather than the importance of reading, not only listening, of course, to the BBC, but also an unruly and lightly regulated press.
But Sir Alan, even those who might share your horror at the idea of another public inquiry are particularly, I suppose, on the left, but you think of people in Reform as well, just think the press overstepped the mark and there ought to be things that could be done now to stop that. Are you saying that that's irrelevant or that it's just not true, that it doesn't happen?
It's not irrelevant. It's just when they say things ought to be done, immediately raises the question, well, what? What further regulation do you need? Leveson gave his recommendations that, on the whole, although not completely, they were followed by the creation of IPSO. And it seems to me that while people will differ as the results of different cases, on the whole, the right balance has been struck. The most important thing is that you don't allow politicians to go further forward in tightening the control over the newspapers. It's very dangerous indeed. And with that, you're going to have, from time to time, a really pretty cruel hounding of individuals. Just wait when Meghan and Harry arrive in this country. You'll see what happens. And one just hopes that there isn't too much triumphalism as a result of the indemnity costs order.
Sir Alan Moses, Fraser Nelson as well. Thank you both.
7 minutes to nine. Earlier in the week, you might remember the brilliant story of 88-year-old Mick Wadge. We heard him on the programme. He started weightlifting only a few years ago after his wife died, and he started with a broom handle and milk containers. But now he's lifting big weights and he's a social media sensation.
I do four sessions a week, Monday, Wednesday and Friday. And Tuesday, I'm coached by Ross. We do about an hour and a half. We do go through all the weightlifting. It's changes as we go along. We deadlift, bench press, we use the machines. It's a full workout.
And it's not just Mick who's getting stuck in with new challenges in retirement. Anthony Hopkins said this week that he is releasing an album at 88. By the way, I said at 8 o'clock that it was his first. And most of the places where you read about it will tell you that it's his first. But it's not. It's his second. And I know that thanks to Sam Jackson, who's the controller of Radio 3 in the BBC Proms, who's very kindly emailed me to point that out. He worked on the first and it was called Composer from 2012. So Anthony Hopkins's second album, but 88, not a bad age to still be doing new things. Anne Youngson is with us, wrote her first published novel, Meet Me at the Museum, at the age of 70. And Bren Neal, as an academic, renewed her passion for dance at the age of 72. Morning, both. Welcome to the programme.
Good morning.
Hello.
Anne, what? Because we all, there's this theory, isn't there, that we all have a book in us. But when did you decide that you were going to actually search for yours and bring it out and properly put it on paper?
When I took early retirement, I think, it was a question of actually finding the time to do the thing I'd always wanted to do, I'd always wanted to get better at, I'd always wanted to do properly, if you like. So it was a passion that sort of coalesced into a book, which was finally published, although that wasn't actually necessarily my ambition. My ambition was just to work at improving at doing the thing that I love doing.
Mm. And it was different to your job as well, because you, or dare I say, you had a proper job. You were you were an engineer. So this was a, you know, something, as you say, that you love to do, that was very different to what you'd done all of your working life.
Oh, exactly. Yes. I mean, I think I would have started earlier if I hadn't had an interesting job. But I enjoyed the work that I was doing, and I had children and, a home. And it never seemed appropriate to spend the time doing the thing that I really, really wanted to do, because I had lots of other commitments and other things that mattered.
Yes, I think many, many of us will recognise that. Bren, I know that, well, you've read Anne's book. You like it. You're a fan.
I have. It's a great book, and I'm looking forward to more.
Are there more to come, Anne?
I am working on something slightly different. I mean, I've published two more novels and a book of short stories since Meet Me at the Museum, but I am now working on something slightly different.
Good, good. The fans want you to keep it coming. And Bren, I thought the point Anne made there was a really good one about you just have this period in life where there are so many other people around you that you're thinking about, that doing something purely for you can be quite a hard thing to make time for.
That's absolutely right. And I spent many years as an academic researcher. I was just too busy to find time for things that I loved, like dancing and music. But 3 years ago, after I'd published my last book, I joined a dance charity called Ascendance. And at the age of 72, quite miraculously, I turned myself into a dancer. And it's been a huge transformation and a very unexpected one.
How did you, because I bet there are people listening who think, I would love to do that, but I wouldn't know how to start, or it just feels like such a departure. So how did you do it?
Well, I was very lucky because Ascendance is on my doorstep. Ascendance supports older dancers like myself and those with neurological conditions, people with Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis and so on. It's very inclusive. And you can just start gently. You go in, and it's amazing to see people go into that space. They may sit for a while, and then they, after some time, they get up and they start moving. And the joy that comes with that is a pleasure to behold.
How do you feel when you dance, Bren?
Well, it's absolute joy. It's free-flowing contemporary. It's very creative. We're encouraged to collectively choreograph our dances with an amazing team to help and support us. And what we're doing is using dance as a form of storytelling. It's not that different from what Anne Younger does, actually, in some ways. And we're sharing those experiences and supporting each other. So the camaraderie in that group, it's amazing. We can all take part at whatever level we happen to find ourselves in, and that's fine.
Ah, yes. That is the key point, isn't it? You don't need to do it brilliantly or wonderfully. And in our last 30 seconds or so, what would you say, just briefly, to someone who is listening to this, who might be inspired to go out and try something new now?
Oh, well, I just do it, but actually also enjoy it. And I really pick up on something that Bren said about doing it with other people, sharing the experience and learning from each other, and building something together with other people who love the same thing.